Honorable Mpumlana, can you put the mic on, or maybe go closer to your mic?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry, ma'am. Apologies. It will. Okay, ma'am, is this better? Ma'am, should I start from the beginning, ma'am, or would it be?
I think it's fine. You've just made the introduction only.
So in respect of the presentation today, I acknowledge respectfully that a number of supporting departments who are part of the CRC are here, and that they will also be giving their presentations as well. So in regards to that, I don't want to take away from what they will be presenting. So there are certain elements of the presentation where I'll talk to from a high-level point of view, taking into account that there will be amplification of those respective elements from those departments as well. The other aspect which I will also respectfully do is to talk to the presentation as opposed to reading every single slide out and emphasize the portions which I believe are very critical and important when talking to the CRC. In terms of the presentation, what we are going to be covering are the critical elements relating to the cybersecurity infrastructure, the various institutional mechanisms, what has led to from a legislative and policy imperatives, as well as where we are in respect of implementation. During the presentation, I will also share with you some of the reflections we've had in terms of, as departments, we're having walked this journey collectively together. There are certain challenges which we've experienced, and I'll talk to the context of those challenges and why those challenges need to be addressed and how we've tried to get there. In terms of 2012, the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework, the NCPF, had created a responsibility in which the SSA was required to lead and develop a cybersecurity approach for the country. In terms of cybersecurity, especially as more and more elements are becoming digital and are becoming web-enabled and are finding themselves onto the internet, it becomes a critical element of counterintelligence. Up to the point that one looks at how the internet has developed, the extent to which cybersecurity and cyber threats were understood was often understood as a context of cybercrime. The issue of intelligence in itself, so far as cyber attacks are concerned, that now becomes something that becomes critical for us to start looking at from an intelligence perspective, and this is where it was found from that point in time. The most critical challenge that you will find actually is found in the last bullet, creating a coherent and structured coordination and management of these activities in the Republic. One of the challenges we have is that everybody wants to do the right thing towards dealing with cybersecurity. But what they do is they approach the thing in a silo. So each person adopts the approach of, this is my mandate, I will solve the problem within my mandate. But what we don't get to is a relay. So you get everybody working within their respective silos, trying to solve the problem, but when the handover of the baton has to occur between department and department, that's where the challenge comes across. And in dealing with that, one of the critical things we've had to do is find a way, and that's where you find this whole CRC comes about. The next thing that we found was that when you start trying to unpack the elements of this, if you're not dealing with the responsibilities which are cross-cutting and you don't have the handover of the baton, you also don't have a situation where the information pertaining to a cybersecurity incident is shared between us. So everybody then approaches the problem within their respective mandates, but not necessarily in an integrated manner. This is where CRC has a critical role to play. It also has a role to play because at the end of the day, from a financial and budget point of view, investing in capacity, infrastructure, resources in each department, if we don't have a coordinated focus, is not going to necessarily be beneficial. It is simply going to get us to a position where we will be spending more and more, but the returns on investment do not necessarily follow. In terms of structurally, the entire context of this, how it fits together, is demonstrated on the slide. Now, the various departments from the DoD, if you go down to, and I will speak to each of this subsequently in the presentation, if you look at the various departments starting on that line called Cyber Command, which belongs to the DoD, the GovCSET belongs to SSA, the Cybersecurity Hub is a DTPS element, and the National Cybercrime Unit is with SAPS. Each of us have responsibilities within this space. But the ability to integrate it, and that's the critical element, is where this response committee comes together. Because it ensures that, as far as is possible, we don't have people working at cross purposes. We have everybody trying to move in the same direction. During the presentation as well, you will find there's other departments that are going to be mentioned. That was the interesting thing for us. Originally, when this problem was conceived, we thought these four or five departments were the leading players. We realized subsequently that there are other departments that actually have got critical roles to play in this. Examples of that, for example, of people who you may not have thought of initially, are people like NASFAS. NASFAS, for example, insofar as they have to give students actually loans or bursaries, have to be able to uniquely identify everyone. In other words, you literally need to get to, at some point, a digital ID for everybody there. In terms of, if you go as far as SASA, at some point you're going to have to do the very same thing. Because if you deal with that, you will find that between everybody who gets a student bursary and everybody who would have to get a SASA grant, the bulk of the population would be catered for, and you'd have to then deal with digital IDs for them. You'd have to do that as a precursor to eventually eliminating things like medical aid fraud when you go to a health system if you want to deal with that. So what happens is some of these things look very simple up front, but as you start unpacking it, you find there's more and more people who actually join this entire journey because of the sheer complexity of the entire journey. Because the one big thing we're going to have to get to at some point is digital ID for every citizen. If you go back to the electronic signature, we need to ensure that you've got a digital signature for every single citizen at some point so that when you interact with government, we know who you are. Because until we can actually uniquely identify who you are, we can't ensure that identity theft doesn't occur and all the cybercrime associated with that doesn't get dealt with. So if you were able to roll out a digital ID for everybody who was a taxpayer, everybody who got a grant, and everybody who got a student bursary, or as such, you would cater comfortably for probably about 45 million people on average. But you see, that's where we've realized that the problem is not as simple and as straightforward as it sounds. And when people sometimes ask the question, why has it taken so long to get going in terms of translating a framework into actual action, where the wheels hit the ground and we start driving a car? The challenge is because of these complexities. The more we start unpacking this thing, the more we start looking at where the problems lie, the more complex the problems get. But what is also encouraging is the commitment of the departments that are here, and the other departments who, while they may not be here, have supported the entire CRC process. In that regard, there's commitment. In that regard, the departments are pulling together because we're recognizing that we can only do this together. The elements which you will see in terms of this now, in terms of this background, the critical challenges in this is actually around infrastructure and institutional capacity. One of the problems we've got when we talk about this, and I'll speak to it now, I'll even emphasize it later, is very often people will give you a budget, and if you want to imagine, it's like trying to change the tires on your car. You have enough money to change one tire, but you can't change one tire on the car. You have to change the front two or the back two, and then you must rotate. Because you never get enough money to change two tires, you can't afford to spend the money on the one tire because it doesn't get you anywhere. The next year comes and they give you money for the other tire, but they took the money away for the first tire. So now you're stuck in the same position. And 4 years later, somebody says, but we gave you money for four tires, but what they didn't tell you is every year they gave you money for one tire, and you couldn't afford to change it because you don't have money for the alignment. I wish that I was maybe more eloquent and I could come up with a better way of explaining it, but I used to be a teacher years ago, so that's my best example when I have to tell the story. But literally, this is what happened. So 4 years later, everybody concludes, you didn't change the tires, you didn't align it, and unfortunately, the car is going nowhere, but you never got enough money for two tires at a time. And this is why we never seem to get past this problem. We seem to go around the problem, we debate the problem, we create institutional mechanisms to solve the problem, but we don't actually get to the bottom line problem, which is until this thing is properly funded with coherent, clear leadership, we will never get this right. And where we started then trying to deal with this is the following. We actually took a long look at the issue as all the departments concerned, and we said, there's just not enough money for everybody to, quite frankly, buy one tire going at this rate. The problem's never going to get solved. It is a problem where, ma'am, when we say from 2012 to 2018, we are still trying to get from a framework to actually translating something into action, and now we're debating a bill, with no disrespect, that we still need to get this work done. This thing has to happen because fundamentally it is outcomes for which we are required as officials to deliver. And for these outcomes to be delivered, we have to sit down and say to everybody, it's time to now be open and to be frank and to be honest about where we find ourselves. We then looked at it and we said, amongst all the departments, can we come up with a coherent shopping list? We then looked at this and we said, the biggest challenge is trying to find the right people. A lot of the skills that you require in order to defend are skills that unfortunately people develop, quite frankly, by hacking and breaking into things. So by virtue of an example, about approximately 18 years ago, before I went to the central bank, when I was in retail banking, my career started by a retail bank paying me to break into their systems. That's how I what I was paid to do. Literally break into their systems. It was a retail bank that's now one of the big four. Because that's how they secured themselves. I did my MBA through the University of Wales on how banks secure themselves into online banking, based on writing about how you break into banks. This is the problem when it comes to the personnel elements. The people you have to hire who've got the skills to be able to do this, you have to vet. And some of them may not necessarily pass the vetting. Insofar as the skills they've acquired, they've had to acquire it, quite frankly, having to break and enter into places. That's what hackers do. Unless they were hired to do it, they're ethical hackers. But this is what some of the challenges are we have. The issue of training and development, insofar as we are now seeing state actors participating in cybersecurity attacks, cybersecurity hacks, you need that degree of investment and you need that degree of skill. In terms of the ability to ensure that we have the right location, we have to implement disaster recovery, we've got to get a location that is safe, because the moment you put this location up, it's going to become the target for every single hacker. As a hacker, you will make your name if you can break into our center, so you must rest assured everybody's going to be trying. They currently try anyway. In terms of the hardware and software elements, this shopping list from everything from security infrastructure to proprietary software in terms of that looks like every single thing we could come up with. Now, to give this house some degree of comfort about how we try to approach this problem, we conducted approximately 3 weeks ago an exercise where we started doing proper scenario planning. So what we actually did, ladies and gentlemen, was rather than simply saying, we could have a hack attempt, we could have threats, what we did is, as a collective in the CRC, we sat down and we said, let us build a proper scenario planning workshop in which we will define all the potential scenarios of how we can be hacked, how we can be attacked. Because until you've got a common playbook about how these hacks could occur or how these things can happen, all you're still getting to the point is we bought a soccer kit, everybody's wearing their soccer kit, we have a soccer ball. And we know the rules of soccer, but we still don't know how we're going to play this game. We're just going to pitch up and hope that the opposition play soccer the way we want them to play. Hopefully we'll score a few goals and not a few own goals. To avoid that, and to avoid taking a position where we cannot justify this investment, we actually conducted this exercise. So we have started defining what are the threat scenarios. If these threat scenarios occur, what will be the responses of the respective parties? How will those parties operate together? In other words, we've gone back to what is politely called a playbook approach. We will define the scenarios, we'll define the way everybody will operate, we'll put mechanisms in place to drive interoperability, right down to a practical point of somebody saying, if something happens, I pick the phone up, I phone X. X will do this. This one will this is the extent that we are driving it to. Because the problem is that we cannot come before this Honorable House and say, please give us all these things, and you'll give us all these things, and then we turn around and come back next year and say, you know, we still have a problem. Because that's not going to demonstrate what is, for me, the issue of the missing leadership. That is what has been why I raised that issue. The leadership in this space required a practical thing to, how do we get to an outcome? And what does this outcome look like? In this case, it was winning that soccer match and being consistently at the top of the league. To do that, we've got to have a proper playbook in which everybody defines it. And it must be driven on the virtue of a scenario planning exercise where every threat is clearly understood, clearly defined. And even if we all disagree as departments about how we thought it should have been, we've at least got a battle plan to approach it. And in that regard, our colleagues in DOD helped guide that. So that is still going through the process, but we started using that as the mechanism to drive this. And all these things which we are coming up with find a home as being the minimum building blocks that we had to have. In this terms of this list, one of the challenges that we get to is, as you're going to find more and more data is coming all through the internet, and more data has to be monitored, and more departments have to be monitored, one of the critical challenges is that in order for you to be able to run a proper security operations center, you've got to be able to monitor the perimeter of all the government departments. So you need a fairly strong degree of connectivity to be able to do that. At this point, I will also remind the House, if you remember the famous story of ComSec, which was supposed to run the government's electronic tripwire, much of what you hear and much of what I talk about is not that different from that logic. And that logic goes back more than 10 years. And the reason why I am highlighting this to the House is because it would be very disingenuous of me to present this as if some of these things are totally new. The irony is that much of what I'm saying to you has been around for more than 10 years, and that is frustrating even to us as officials. Because for those of us who live in the space who actually want to see this thing fixed, we have seen the iterations. We've seen it start off with a ComSec approach to running an electronic tripwire all the way up to this. So when we talk about connectivity, one of the biggest challenges ComSec even had then was, how do you connect multiple government departments and multiple feeds into a monitoring center, let alone when the attack is going to come from an internet service provider? What do you do? Because if we find an internet service provider is being used to facilitate an attack, what is the practical outcome? You can't exactly necessarily switch off an entire ISP easily, because that ISP also carries commercial clients. There's impacts to that. In terms of standard operating procedures, policies are useful in terms of being able to define the way in which we approach what we are trying to do and the way in which we have a common understanding. But beyond policies, we've got to get to practices. One of the challenges we've had is to come to a common mindset. In that regard, I acknowledge my colleagues in the CRC because that has been very helpful in terms of forming a common mindset. In terms of the various infrastructure elements, I know that the respective departments will talk to themselves in terms of their role, but I'll talk to this in principle. In terms of our ability to be able to encrypt data such that it cannot easily be penetrated and be unraveled, we depend on cryptographers significantly. But in order for us to be able to, in the event of a hacking incident, provide the full skills in terms of a CERT, where we have an incident response capability that's capable of actually figuring out who has actually committed the hack, how it was committed, and actually trace it right down to a forensics level, we need specialist skills. We have skills in this field, but clearly as this role expands, we will need more skills. And we're also mindful of the fact that we don't want to be in a situation where we have skills and none of our fellow departments do. So a lot of this is going to require skill sharing, matrix management, and an understanding that we have to work together. Viewed simply, the time for each one trying to do it on its own isn't going to work anymore. Now, the SSA is driving collaboration completely and totally. We are the glue that binds insofar as we try to ensure that everyone is able to work together. The DoD, in terms of their role, they were going to establish basically the Cyber Command and to put together an entire threat intelligence center. This is the reason why we asked them to assist us with regards to the building of those scenario planning. Because what we try to ensure is that the parties who have to actually deliver on their responsibilities have the opportunity to play that role from the start. What is crucial is that while the SSA has had the responsibility to play a leadership role, leadership on its own cannot be leadership if we lead simply from the front. It's got to be leadership where our colleagues are at our sides as well, and that's what we have tried to do. And the DoD has been helpful in that regard. Our colleagues from SAPS, who are next to me, SAPS has participated in the CRC in terms of, we have representation from SAPS Crime Intelligence, we have representation from SAPS Detective Services, from the Hawks in terms of the Electronic Crimes Unit, as well as the Civilian Secretary. So all four are technically represented on the CRC, however a single representative normally attends. What is important insofar as SAPS is concerned? We have been working with our colleagues in SAPS insofar as when they have required specialized skills around forensics and elements like that, we have given them the assistance wherever we could. Ultimately, I think the challenge is this. It's about finding each other. And in sort of, the one thing that the bill has helped us do is actually concretize how we have to find each other. It's given us a starting point for that. In terms of the DOJ, our colleagues are here in terms of giving us advice from a legal perspective. One of the interesting parts which we've often found is that when you leave technical people to solve a problem, they'll normally go off and solve it in technical ways. That's the nature of it. If a laptop were to crash today, 20 technical people will have 18 opinions, and 52 solutions, because two of them was watch and supervise, of course, on how to fix it. But sometimes technical people don't necessarily take into account that there is the law, and there are ways in which, for example, you have to take cognizance of the fact that the evidence has to be preserved insofar as the culprits have to be found, because all we're interested in doing normally is fixing the problem. So we've benefited from the fact that our colleagues, from a legal perspective, have at least introduced that. In the same way, DIDCO has also helped. DIDCO has made us, for example, familiar or fair with the view that we have to ensure that what we do takes into account how South Africa has to interoperate with other countries in respect of dealing with cybercrime and cybersecurity issues. In other words, in the same way that no department is an island on this matter, no country can necessarily be an island in the matter. On this slide, you find SARS, for example, comes in. Now, if you look at the bill doesn't necessarily speak to SARS in the bill per se in terms of one of the CRC departments. But SARS is on the CRC. And the reason for this is because insofar as SARS is able to provide assistance, they reconcile, obviously, all of the tax returns. They hold 7.7 million at a minimum taxpayer information size. The rest of the taxpayer information they hold in respect to corporates, etc. What is crucial about this is that insofar as SARS maintains this information, if you have to start protecting critical points of information and you look at things such as fraud, if you can, for example, target SARS and you take SARS down, the impact is significant, critically. This is why we've had to involve SARS in this. And this is what has happened. The CRC has become an evolving function as opposed to something cut and dry. The other thing which we've realized is because of the nature of what SARS does, they introduce electronic forms, electronic e-filing, critical systems that have to at some point be rolled out to the rest of government, if you look at e-filing or electronic forms as a concept. Where that is concerned, if we can pioneer and figure out how they need to lock themselves in from a security point of view of protecting themselves, that same playbook logic can be applied to everybody else who has got e-forms to deal with. In respect of DTPS, I know my colleague from DTPS is to my left, Dr. Pillay. The interesting element is that insofar as the hub is looking at first membership, I'm only going to speak to that one element because I acknowledge that my colleague is here. More than, ladies and gentlemen, I must now go back in my mind, 11 years ago, approximately, 10, 11 years ago, when I was initially at State Security, I know that we were trying to get first membership for ComSec at that stage, and we were trying to get country sponsorship from another country in Africa, which had at that stage the only first membership. Today is an example of how 10, 11 years later, we're still trying to get first membership. And what is interesting is that insofar as this is concerned, there are banks that have got first level membership in terms of incident response. This is an example of why the need to get this right has to get the necessary will behind it. Because in the absence of doing that, 10 years from now, the same problem is going to resuscitate itself, and it's just going to come up under a different name. From an SSA point of view, these capabilities currently are within the SSA. We currently do have an alert and warning function, which we provide. If you subscribe to that on our website, you will receive alerts as it comes out in terms of potential security threats. We undertake vulnerability assessments and vulnerability handling for government departments insofar as if you have a need to know, can you be penetrated from a hacker? We will actually come to on-site and we will actually run a full-scale assessment and we'll detail all your findings. Now, what's interesting is the very work we do allows you to actually save, because if we didn't do it, you'd have to go to external auditors to do that. So we do the very same thing the auditors do. Except what we do is we actually sit with you and we then help you fix it. Because what we found was, although from alerts and warnings, which is notifying you of the possibility of something going wrong or you being hacked, right up to us being able to do the actual vulnerability testing, it allows us to manage the spectrum of minimizing the likelihood of an attack being successful. Because if all we do is publish warnings, it's like, you know the signs you see saying hijacking hotspots? It's useful to have a sign. But if you don't do something about it, all you'll do is know there's a threat. You will not actually then be able to stop the hijackers. That's what we do with this. But we go one step further. We put in place an advising program where literally we engage you as a customer to say, are your people trained? Do they load the latest patches? Do they know about the latest attacks? Are they in a situation that if the attack occurs, what will they do? So we drive it all the way from awareness right up to literally running the tests for you, right up to proactively engaging. And that function is with me. In addition to that, what we've also got is a cybersecurity center, which we launched last year. We are able to do monitoring at a high level. Bear in mind that when we talk about high-level monitoring, until government departments literally plug their monitoring feeds into us, we won't be able to monitor specific departments as opposed to broadly. The best way of understanding that, ladies and gentlemen, is imagine you are running a normal alarm monitoring center for one of the large security companies. We've got the alarm monitoring center. We can tell you from an alert point of view, because we're monitoring, where the crimes are occurring. But till you take your house alarm and you connect your house alarm to our monitoring center, we won't be monitoring your house. We'll just be monitoring the entire region. And when you connect your house alarm to us, we then have to ensure the connectivity is there. We need to ensure that your house alarm actually monitors every single thing in your house and not just three parts of your house. So all of that still has to happen type of thing in terms of getting this right. The other elements in terms of dealing with this whole government CERT is so far as we can actually resolve the challenges of engagement, our hope is that government departments will come on board and that slowly we'll be able to extend our monitoring footprint. And as we are able to do that and we invest in the necessary infrastructure to support that, we'll be able to give you a better and wider and more in-depth coverage. Right now we have coverage, but the problem is the depth of the coverage is where we need to improve. That as well as the extent to being proactive on this matter. Our colleagues in SAPS are here, so they'll discuss with you the issue of the National Cybercrime Center. The message for me out of this would be, as much as we all accept that cybercrime is transnational and borderless in nature, the biggest issue becomes, how do you actually deal with this? How do you deal with a situation where the crime can be committed, and this is the challenging part, the crime can be committed from one country, but if you deal with hackers who are good, they will literally point you in the direction of another country. I can go out today and I can go and buy a server, and I won't mention which countries I can do this in. I can go and buy a server in a country. I can launch an attack from another country. I can make it look like this country is where the attack is coming from and it's actually launched from here. Meanwhile, all along here's the nice thing, I'm sitting in this country here because I'm routing this attack through different servers. So what I'm doing is I'm simply pointing you to different areas. Now, by the time you find out which country I did that in, and you get the necessary subpoenas, and you go through their court process, I'm gone. And when I say I can buy that server, so to speak, I can buy time on that server for probably less than $100. And I can set up a complex attack like that in probably less than a day without having to do much. And if I really wanted to mess with the system and I know how the rail networks work, I can buy access in one country and I can move to another country and I can create chaos by making an attack bounce from country to country, and you still wouldn't find me anyway, even if you were looking for me. Now that's how hackers operate. And when hackers can operate like that, the job of our police is even more difficult. Because unlike a case where you have the smoking gun and you can find the body and you can hopefully with forensics correlate the two, here the smoking gun is not the smoking gun. The body could be the body and the crime scene could shift. The crime scene could shift, and in that case, this becomes very complicated. Insofar as DTPS brings into this the ability to interconnect additional sector CERT, so for each of the industries, there is a desire to set up security incident response teams, so for example, for banking, transport, etc. The issue which they are trying to do is to create basically a force multiplier where they're able to leverage the incident response teams of different sectors. So these things almost become like sensors that pick up attacks, because you could find banking detects an attack before the rest of us does. But once that attack vector has been determined, it actually is something that somebody will use to attack some other part. So put simply, while the attack vectors or the method of the attack may remain consistent, which part of the CERT detects the attack first could vary. Because depending on how this thing works out, not every attack, for example, will be targeted against the bank. Not every attack will be targeted against state resources. If you take, for example, certain situations, like the one about the breach that occurred of 63 million details pertaining to citizens. It was a breach that occurred last year. That information is already on the dark web. Now, the dark web is that side of the internet where things happen that nobody wants to ever admit to. It's the darker side of the internet. Literally, it's a place where, for example, you will find elements such as pornography is distributed, illegal material is distributed, people's credit card information is distributed, etc. So information is bought and sold on it. You'll even hear the word the Silk Road talked about in the dark web context. If you take things like the Ashley Madison breach, for example, that occurred previously, that information was sold on the dark web. Now, one of the biggest challenges is that insofar as DTPS has to pull the different pieces together, if a breach of that 63 million occurs again, and that information is not government, not necessarily from a government server, it's from a commercial point of that it's breached, the industry responsible has to also take responsibility for actually solving that problem. Because while we are all responsible collectively, that industry has to also set down guidelines in terms of information protection beyond what is already legislatively there. They've also got to deal with the issue of a breach of trust. Because what you will find that in the absence of doing that, there's a gap. And that is the gap that this attempts to remediate. I've spoken to this. I think the interesting one which I found was the bottom element, the issue of the collaborative software solutions. One of the interesting things that DTPS brought to us was that in order for you to be able to deal with this problem fast enough and most effectively, you need to have a method to communicate between all the parties. Because what we found, which was sometimes interesting, is what we may call a crime or a hack, we describe a different vocabulary. And because we describe it with different vocabulary, we all agree that something happened. But how we describe that something becomes a challenge. And until we can all agree on that, which is what we've had to come to a degree of understanding, and we have software that actually allows interoperability amongst the parties, you find that the same incident could be reported in different ways. Imagine if you were a hijacking occurs, or an attempted hijacking. One person heard, for example, a gunshot, so he phoned the police and said, I heard a gunshot. The next one heard a breaking of the glass, maybe, for the car. The third person reported that they heard somebody screaming. Now, it sounds like three different things are being reported, when it's actually one crime. And to be able to get that right, we found that this was the only way to do it, and DTPS is working on that at the moment. In terms of the cybersecurity hub, as well as the National Cybersecurity Advisory Council, they will speak to that. I think the issue for me, which is what I'd like to share, is this issue of a threat response protocol. What we have found is that in respect of how to report breaches, if we do not regulate that, and we don't have a clarity of what we are reporting, people then choose what they wish to report and what they don't report. So if you go into out of interest that 63 million data breach, when you go into it, you'll find something like there's up to about 12 or 14 databases that are integrated into one. There's about 22 sheets. It took us a while to figure out how you got to 63 million people. It's because people are deceased are also included on it. Just being able to figure out where that breach occurred and was easy in terms of the outcome. But where was all that information obtained from? Being able to trace all that information, now that's where the challenge comes in. Was that information obtained legally, or was that information obtained through a breach somewhere else? And if it was breached somewhere else, how was that then merged? Again, I'm not saying that how it was obtained. I'm saying you can't on its own, when information is then found, especially when it is exposed, say the breach occurred only at the point of the breach. It could have occurred at multiple points, and the person who breached it is only the aggregator of the information that you are accessing. Our colleagues from DIRCO, insofar as this slide speaks to, are responsible for the issues of ensuring all international engagement around cybercrime and cybersecurity is aligned. One of the things which we found, and we've therefore come to an understanding with DIRCO on this, is that where assistance was concerned, different foreign governments would approach different of these departments and offer to help. But the problem was if each one would help a respective department and there would be no integration. So learning between the departments didn't occur, and the agendas of those countries necessarily helping wasn't necessarily scrutinized. So we weren't sure whether we were being helped on one side or we were dealing with the Trojan horse on the other. Insofar as, you know, that famous saying of there's no such thing as a free meal, you actually have to know sometimes when you're being offered help whether people are actually offering to help you or whether they're trying to assess your skills and capabilities and your competencies. So in the event that they have to attack you, they know where your weaknesses lie. So there's that element which one must also consider insofar as one must accept the assistance or contemplate accepting it. So with DIRCO, we've got a process whereby now, if any of the CRC departments get an offer for help, it is tabled. We go through identifying whether that is within the position that we've got. That is reconciled by them, and then we look at what does it mean for us from a security point of view. Because very often in some of these cases, in order to get the assistance, you have to give people access to certain elements of your infrastructure that is sensitive, that they wouldn't have gotten to previously. And you've then got to weigh out the threats from an intelligence perspective on that. This slide speaks to simply the legislative elements that are there, that DIRCO will be able to expand further on. The challenges that we have, and when you read this list looks sometimes almost as if it could describe any series of challenges anybody offers to a problem. In a nutshell, it talks to resourcing, personnel, infrastructure, and retention. The reason why I'm starting by saying that to the House is because when you look at this and you say, but what's so different between this and any other problem that we've had to implement a solution for? The challenge is that the budget for this problem has often been separated amongst all the departments. And because the budget is separated without one person becoming the quartermaster of the matter, it becomes very difficult to ensure that everybody, once they've gotten the money, actually spends in the same direction. Now, what the SSA has been doing is engaging with National Treasury as part of trying to explain the entire problem statement. We've had to go through engagements with them where we're showing them this is what the threat profiles are. They've come to our cybersecurity center. They've seen what it looks like. They've seen how we can monitor for attacks. And we've shown them why, without further investment, we're not in a position to go beyond certain things because we've got limitations. We're grateful to National Treasury for the time that they're spending with us and for their assistance in this regard. What we've also recognized is we need to create a cybersecurity skills development and training program. These skills need to be created, and the investment has to start, and we have to drive these skills. The reality is that even with all the will to driving these skills, incubating them at the agency, training people to do this, these skills, even if we start today, are not going to be online in 6 months' time. They're not going to be online in a year's time because it takes not just the training, but the ability to know when you are seeing an attack, what sort of attack you are seeing. So in the same way, for example, I use the thing where I can make an attack look like it comes from different countries. I can also distract you. Because I want to tie up your time, I launch multiple fake attacks and you spend all your time chasing fake attacks when the real attack is coming from somewhere else. That is another tactic we use as hackers. Now, to be able to pick that up is a gut feel. I can't express it in any other way. You can be trained, you can have the best technology in the world, you can have the best tool set, but it's only with experience that you know the person is actually trying to distract me from X, they're targeting Y. And you can figure it out because eventually you have an instinct that tells you this. To develop that instinct is going to take time, and it's only experience that can give people that. In terms of the issue of adequate skills, building on these skills also requires us to create cybersecurity professionals who can work across the various departments. We are talking about how to rotate people amongst ourselves. We're talking about how to cross-skill people amongst ourselves. What we're also talking about is how do we work together with, for example, their basic education, higher education, to be able to deal with these issues. Because in order for you to have sound IT skills, you also have to have certain other skills, such as math skills and elements like that. In terms of the technical infrastructure, we want to put together a national cybersecurity infrastructure plan that will come from the SSA. But what we are very sensitive about is we don't want to give you a shopping list. Giving you another shopping list and telling you 10 years from now that we are not still able to take this thing and drive it is not going to help anyone. We want the infrastructure plan to be driven from a perspective of what are the threats, hence that scenario planning workshop and that threat-driven approach to solving it. So that when we say we require two wheels to be changed this year, two tires to be changed this year, and the following year we need to rotate the other two and change them and then switch them around, this is formed based on an exact set of scenarios. So even when we can't do everything in 1 year, we know what the risk is of exposure. In terms of the retention strategy, we are competing for skills that are in demand from the financial institutions as well as industry in general. Hacker skills are in short supply in general. And to be able to, quite frankly, retain and recruit these skills is a challenge. Because to be open, we are not necessarily economically a competitive employer when it comes to these skills. So the people who tend to join because they actually believe this is a calling, it's a passion. Because I spent 10 years in banking, the reason why, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't go back to banking is because I do what I do to keep the country safe, and I love what I do, and I'm blessed and fortunate to be able to do that every day. But insofar as that is concerned, I also have to recognize that if you have youngsters with these skills who are trying to start off their lives, and you put them on a government salary, they look at that salary, they look at what they're being offered by the big four banks, and they say to you, honestly, chief, we can get X amount more if we go there. What can you do for us? And you are limited because you have got a pay scale to work on that the industry doesn't. You can't offer them share options. You can't offer them a subsidized property rate for their homes. That is the economic reality. And against that reality, we land up in a situation where we train people and then they go to industry. But you see, that actually helps also. So as much as I complain, it does help. Because the C-certs that are formed in the industry are then actually formed by people who we trained, people who we socialized, people who have our way of doing it. So as much as we complain that we keep on acting as a feeder system to training people, we also have to be honest enough to say that it actually does help, because if we didn't do it like that, and nobody was poaching our people, then we wouldn't have a situation where the other C-certs in industry would get stopped. So it's a double-edged sword, but it does create a situation where we are perpetually a training institution. In terms of the recommendations, the enactment of this bill and the translation of this bill obviously into an act will help us, but it will also then bind the understanding of how the various parties have to interoperate. Because up to now, you know, we've been working together, but we would obviously, from the point of the bill concretizing that, it would remove the dependency on it being, because people know each other and they work together long enough that they cooperate. It would actually formalize that element. The other aspects which I would highlight out of this is the issue of the public-private sector engagement. Insofar as that is concerned, we are recognizing more and more that cybersecurity is not just solely a government issue or not solely just a private sector issue, but it requires cooperation. That is an element that DGPS is driving. The last aspect is the issue of putting together a proper cybersecurity research and development agenda. The ability to start developing skills in terms of potential hacks, or what we sometimes refer to as zero-day attacks, where it's a totally unique attack that has never been created before, against which no defense exists. To be able to develop that is a critical set of skills in terms of, if you can develop those attacks, you can develop the counters against it. That's the interesting thing about this. The very skills that are required to be able to hack into something are the same skills that you're required to defend against it, because only if you understand how to break into it can you know how to stop it. So when you look at these departments and you think, some of these departments specialize in actually how to actually hack into something, others specialize in how to defend, how do they all come together? It's because we all balance each other out in terms of having an understanding of the problem. Because so far as we understand how something can be penetrated, we also have to be able to defend against the very same thing. And because there are other departments who are trying to defend perpetually against it, we have the benefit of always saying to them, okay, so if we had to do X, how would you do Y? Because we're always trying to look for the next best thing to actually try and find the lock and the key that will actually open it and then open every other lock that we could find. So that makes this a very exciting and very interesting space to be in. But unfortunately, it's also a very expensive space to be in, and it's a space where you continually have to be at the top of your game. And that is why even the investment that you make in this goes beyond just the singular investment. Ma'am? That brings me, ladies and gentlemen, to the end of my presentation. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Motley, for the presentation. This was the base document that is actually assisting to create the base for the discussion for meaningful inputs by the government departments. We're going to be looking at the following departments for inputs, and maybe before that, let me take the opportunity of welcoming from the executive, Deputy Minister Llewellyn Lindis from DERCO. So we will get a presentation from SAPS, from Department of Telecommunication. We'll get a presentation from NPA. Delco, I'm not sure whether you are ready for the presentation or you'll just make a comment. You're ready for the presentation. And defense. Is defense here? Okay, good. Thank you. Can we now give the opportunity to SAPS for the presentation? Honorable Mumblana?
Yes, I think we need to. Can we get some clarification from the department as they process?
They will conclude after all the presentations, because like they are saying.
Now, what to do? We want to, because we're dealing with the bill, we want to sort of put what they say into the bill and understanding that. I think it's important to get and understand what they say, how it fits in here, and how solutions can be born. And then when you get each department, they say, because she's not dealing with anything that is related to the bill, just they're telling us the problems and how they are solved. So those are the problems I have.
Thank you, Honorable Mumlana. Don't you want to save that for last after you've heard what other government departments are doing? Because that's the approach that you are adopting now.
Well, normally a person, by the time you get to the last man, you may have forgotten what the first man was saying and how relevant it is to the why do you want us to go through all of them? We need to have a trend, don't we?
State security. Do you think it will be appropriate now or maybe right at the end like it has been suggested?
Ma'am, I think that given that the other departments are here to present their respective areas, one of the things I was very sensitive about is I did not want to steal their thunder, for the lack of a better phrase, by actually giving their presentations on their behalf. So I've had to, ma'am, as a base document, introduce the concepts, create a reference frame for their respective presentations. My understanding, ma'am, is that each of them is offering a further amplification on the base document, and that if there are areas, ma'am, that therefore have not been covered, ma'am, my respectful submission is that that should be taken at the end, because everything that everybody says after me, ma'am, is actually just an expansion of that, or they've emphasized areas where they have further wish to draw the House's attention to it. But it's not a situation where, ma'am, I'm expecting anybody to introduce anything totally new or to go to deviate from the base document.
Thank you. And then at the end, you will then pose questions to you. Thank you. Can we have SAPS then presenting?
Honorable Chairperson and members, I'm Brigadier van Graan of the SAPS Legal Services. I have a whole team here with me, and I will quickly introduce that you just know who are who. Brigadier Pieterse on the extreme left, behind him Brigadier Nkosi from Crime Intelligence. Brigadier Pieterse is from DPCI. General Maxson is from the Detective Service, and my good colleague behind me is from Legal Services, Colonel Bobby. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a very long presentation. I'm going to use my discretion to play in the favor of time. Some of the stuff I will not deal with in great detail, but I will take the honor of my members through and obviously address these things in the questions. If we just look at the outline of the presentation, I will obviously concentrate on point one that you see in front of you. Point two is a summary of the bill. I will not concentrate on that too much because it's just a summary. We do want to look at some issues under point three, issues that must be clarified for us to make this thing workable in practice. The important point, as per the instruction that we received, the call-up, is point four, compliance with clause 54.2 of the bill. That is the capacity and the training that must be established by our minister. And then obviously we would like to look at the extent of cybercrime in South Africa and a conclusion. I do want to apologize that the correctness of the slide, the references there, the slides are actually more than the 42. Just for the sake of completeness, point 4 runs from slide 37 to 42. Point 5 runs from 44 to 46. And the conclusion, 48 to 49. It's just to make it easier for the reference. The current status of cyber crime regulation within the SAPS. The SAPS was and still is an active role player in the National Cyber Security Policy Framework, approved by Cabinet in 2012 and finally published in Government Gazette during December 2015. This policy framework creates an obligation for the SAPS to prevent, investigate and combat cyber crime, which includes the development of policies and strategies and providing for specialized investigative capacity and interaction with national and international stakeholders. These are issues which are regulated in the bill. We spoke previously from the DDG side, cyber security, our mandate in the SAPS is the second bullet, cyber crime. The then acting National Commissioner of Police, Lieutenant General Motiva, approved an interim cybercrime policy for the SAPS on 27 October 2017. The issue of cybercrime was discussed comprehensively at the latest management forum meetings of the SAPS, and as a result, this interim cybercrime policy, the cybersecurity policy framework, and the current version of the bill is in the process of being circulated to all provincial commissioners of the SAPS for general consumption in the police. We must acknowledge that this is a new concept in the police. The interim policy on cybercrime was designed to give guidance to police officials pending the finalization and enactment of this bill before Parliament. The interim policy is therefore not based on this current bill. The SAPS is also already working on a comprehensive integrated operational cybercrime strategy that, where applicable, will be aligned with the provisions of this current bill. This is the point that I said, it's just a summary of the bill. I will go very fast through it for the sake of time and with the chairperson's and honourable members' permission. Basically, to summarise, it's a comprehensive new regime of crime for South African police services that they must be addressing. It is new powers for the police because we have now new search warrants. We are all used to the old Law of Criminal Procedure Act 1997, prior to the era of computers. There is provisions to apply orally for certain directions or warrants. There is unique search warrants, as I mentioned, in terms of this law. Also a new concept, the SAPS can now be assisted by private persons during a search and seizure operation. It's not possible in terms of the current law. Designated police officials obtain certain functions to apply for certain directions. Preservation of evidence, this is also a new concept in criminal law for police. We used to seize goods, we not so much used to the concept of preservation in the criminal law. According to Clause 45, the National Commissioner of the SAPS, with approval from the NDPP, may forward information obtained during investigations to law enforcement agencies of a foreign state. And then very important for us, the 24/7 point of contact, which is the structure in the bill that is created for the police under the auspices of the Minister of Police. This is the structure that is recognized in terms of the bill for the police. The point of contact is required to provide immediate assistance with regard to proceedings or investigations pertaining to cybercrime in chapters 2 and 3 of the bill. And we, therefore, it is in our acknowledge that crime in the form of cybercrime is a borderless crime if you look at the point of contact. The assistance that we will get, legal assistance, is not to be provided in-house, it's to be provided by the Office of the National Director of Public Prosecutions for legal assistance. And as was said by the DGG Moodley previously, SAPS is an active member of the Cyber Response Committee. The Minister of Police may make regulations in respect of all the above obligations and must, this is now in terms of the bill, at the end of each financial year report to Parliament on the progress pertaining to these obligations, the number of offences pertaining to cyber crimes that were reported to the SAPS, number of cases where no criminal prosecutions were instituted after 18 months, and the number of members of SAPS who received training in respect of cyber crime. Chapter 11 of the bill is also of importance to the police because there is a reference to the critical information infrastructure protection by the State Security Agency. We say we have an interest from SAPS's side because the critical infrastructure protection bill, which will repeal the National Key Points Act, is to be administered by the Minister of Police. So you can see the two interactions here. The bill above, that is the Infrastructure Protection Bill, provides for the identification and declaration of physical infrastructure as critical infrastructure and provides for measures for the protection and the resilience of critical infrastructure. This bill of the police does not deal with information infrastructure that we find in this current bill, or cyber matters, but only physical buildings, transport networks, etc. But there is a mechanism in terms of which the information infrastructure related matters is referred to the Minister of State Security before application of the bill is considered. Provision is made for conclusion of agreements with foreign states, stuff that we are already used to in the police service. Issues that we want to see clarified in the bill, I will also try to summarize as far as possible. We say the reference to cybercrime mostly speaks of the offences in Chapter 2 and Chapter 3. What about all the offences that is amended and inserted in the schedule to the bill? We don't see that reference, so we have a fear that that might be excluded, but it's an absolute technical point. Investigators, we are very happy to be assisted by private investigators. We just say that the bill must clarify their function. We don't want people to carry boxes. We want people that can provide technical know-how expertise to the police. We don't want extra hands. So we want experts, and we think the bill must just clarify that for us in greater detail. The extraterritorial jurisdiction of any court where an offence was committed in the Republic may cause practical problems on grassroots level in respect of the jurisdiction of the specific court that should try the matter. It may also lead to confusion in respect of the place where cases must be investigated among the police, if any court has jurisdiction. This is a big problem always in the police service. They ask you, where is the scene of crime? In the world of cyber environment, the crime scene can be anywhere. And we propose there that the NDPP issue policy guidelines or that some effect be given to such an insertion. We say that the timeline in clause 24 of the bill, in terms of which our minister must within 6 months after commencement of the bill issue SOPs for the investigation of cybercrime, is not feasible. It's a proposed that at least 18 months be allocated to compile these SOPs because these have to be consulted with relevant role players. There is also a provision in the current bill that these SOPs must be published in the Government Gazette. We humbly request that this be removed from the bill. We do not want to inform the public, specifically suspects, how investigations in respect of cybercrime are conducted. Clauses 28 and 41 of the bill. We welcome the principle of oral applications for certain warrants. We don't know whether this is feasible in practice, whether the magistrates and judges will entertain such a step. We have experience from the interception legislation that the designated judge does not want to entertain oral applications, which is quite understandable. Clause 31 of the bill says a police official, and this is a very important point for us, a police official in terms of this provision may only access a computer data storage medium or computer system in accordance with a search warrant. We do say here that we support it, but not under all circumstances. And I'm going to give an example why we say the chairperson and members. Where a person is arrested, this is the current law, he or she may, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, be searched, and any article found in the possession of this person may be seized. That's the current law. Now we say if a suspicious person who is not necessarily investigated by the police is arrested and found with a computer device in his possession, which may afford evidence of the commission of the crime, the SAPS will not be able to apply for a search warrant of that device because we don't know what's contained on that device. It's different where you investigate someone and you focus on this and you know you are looking for child exploitation images or terrorism exploitation or images or whatever the case may be. But if you find someone and you arrest him spontaneously and he has a device, the law now says we must also have a warrant to look at the device. What we're saying is, it is proposed that if the warrant requirement in this clause cannot be deleted from the bill should at least contain a mechanism in terms of which the police can lawfully peep into a device to enable them to apply for a warrant. Any information obtained during such a provisional surveillance or peep should not be admissible as evidence in any proceedings, and disclosure of information obtained during the provisional surveillance should be criminalized. We carry on with clause 31. There is case law here in the High Court Division here in the Western Cape, where it was held by a court in 2015, the High Court, that if the purpose of the seizure of a cell phone is to access the data stored on it, and the police have complied with the search and seizure provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act, they are, in my view, entitled to do the obvious thing that any police officer in possession of a seized object would do, examine it for purposes of establishing its potential use in an offence and the subsequent criminal prosecution of such offence. The situation is no different to the seizure of a bloodied knife being sent for fingerprint and DNA analysis, a photo album being viewed for identification of potential suspects depicted therein, or a telephone or address book being studied to view the handwritten entries therein. Clause 43B of the bill, it is problematic for us. It is subject to multiple interpretations. That's our view. The police, and if, just to say what 43 is, it says the police can receive information from any person who lawfully obtained information. We can't ask everyone whether he or she received information lawfully. We can potentially use anything that we receive. If someone stole information and bring it to the police, or whatever the situation may be, the current provisions say we can't use it because it was not lawfully obtained. I think it is for us as investigators and the prosecuting authority to admit admissible evidence, but that's the only issue for us at stake. Clause 45.1 of the bill is problematic since it brings the NDPP into the domain of crime prevention and investigations. What it is all about is if we want to exchange information from the National Commissioner on Crime Investigations with a foreign nation, the current provisions say we need consent from the NDPP. We are not speaking here about prosecutions, we are only speaking about investigations. So what we're saying is perhaps if we only talk about investigations, will this not prolong the process of exchanging information? This is positive observation and not necessarily a negative remark. The cyber bill, as I said there in the next slide, is premised on the speedy exchange of cyber-related information. Caution should be taken on prescribing administrative processes that might prolong investigations and communication, such as the reference to the role of the NDPP in criminal investigations. Unlawful interception. This is also a very important point for the police service. We say here that search and seizure operations by the SAPS often involve the use of cameras or audiovisual equipment to record or monitor the search and seizure. Where computers are involved, such recording may include a screenshot of a computer to indicate the status thereof during the search. Technically speaking, when we do this, we are breaking the law in terms of the RICA Act, because that is regarded as unlawful interception of indirect communications where any data or information is visible on the screen of the device. It is proposed that the RICA Act be amended to ensure that police officials do not breach the mentioned Act, the RICA Act, in the scenario set out earlier. A possible solution would be to insert it in the current section 4.2 of the bill. I don't want to bore you with the technical detail, Honourable Chairperson and members. Important, related to this, what is the interface between the Cyber Crimes Bill and the RICA? And we say it must be clarified. Clause 38 of the bill, for instance, provides for the interception of indirect communications that it must be authorized in terms of a direction in terms of the RICA. Clause 27 of the bill authorizes access to an article which includes data on the strength of a search warrant issued by any magistrate or judge. And here's our question. It is not clear whether both a RICA direction by the designated judge as well as a search warrant has to be obtained before data can be accessed by the SAPS. I will not go further on that. We ask in the next slide, in the middle, is it not time for public internet facilities and cafes to also be regulated? We just leave it there. We don't want to force our will down or anything, but it's a question that we pose. Is it not time to look at public internet facilities where a lot of crime are perpetrated? Identification of website owners is also important to the police. We must be able to know who are the owners of websites and domain names, and that records are available in respect of website owners, and that can be verified during the registration process. We are all familiar with the RICA and FICA processes where we all have to go through. Why not in terms of this law too, that you have to register your domain name, etc. We note that some common law offences is now addressed in the bill as so-called cyber offences. We see that there's now cyber fraud, cyber extortion, and then there's also an interpretation of the word theft. We say, why don't we also then talk of cyber theft? It's just a technical point. We also are uncertain why only certain common law offences have been brought into the domain of the cyber world. This is the gist of our presentation that we're actually supposed to be talking about, Chairperson, our compliance with Clause 54.2. 54.2 deals with the obligation on the Minister of Police to create capacity and training in the SAPS. The wording is there for convenience sake. The Minister of Police is required to establish sufficient human and operational capacity to address cybercrime, to ensure that members of SAPS receive basic training in respect of the investigation and detection of these crimes, and two, in conjunction with an institution of higher learning, develop and implement accredited training programs for members of the SAPS primarily involved with the detection, prevention and investigation of cybercrime. Now if we look at capacity building initiatives in compliance with Clause 54.2, you will note that we say there that new structures have just been created within the Division Detective Service. I'm now specifically speaking about the Detective Service. They have what they now call Serial and Electronic FCS Investigations Section that was established within the component Family Violence, Child Protection and Sexual Offences. This is to deal with your child exploitators, etc., etc. We have a component commercial crime investigation in the Detective Service, which includes a cybercrime investigation section, which was established. Our organizational development is in the process of finalizing a work study to establish commercial crime units, which include cybercrime investigation capacities on ground level. I'm only speaking about the Detective Service. If we look at the current capacity in the SAPS overall, we say that the current capacity within the SAPS comprises of the following digital, forensic and investigative capabilities. In the DPCI, first of all, we have digital forensic investigation capacity in all provinces except Gauteng, Northwest and which are serviced from National Head Office. So those that are not having a capacity, they are serviced from National Head Office. And we have a cybercrime investigation capacity at National Head Office. That's at DPCI level. In the Detective Service, the component commercial crime, cybercrime investigation, we have a section at National Head Office. And the component Family Violence, Child Protection and Sexual Offences, Serial and Electronic FCS Investigation Section at Head Office, that I've referred to first of all. Serial and Electronic FCS Investigations established in all provinces. We have Operational Command Centre embedded from the Detective Service through Provincial Operational Coordinating Centres at Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. We are now moving over to Crime Intelligence. We have digital forensic and cybercrime support on collection capacities at National Head Office and at all provinces, in all provinces. Training to date, a total of 1,212 SAPS members have completed the introduction of electronic related crime scene course, while 316 members received specialized cyber related training. 59 crime intelligence members received specialized cyber-related training during 2017-2018 financial year. We say they that the development of cyber-related training for SAPS have been initiated. The extent of cybercrime. Dealing with cybercrime operationally includes focusing on the extraction of digital evidence through digital forensics, the investigation of cyber-enabled crime, such as the common law crime of fraud through the internet, and then we have what we call now pure cybercrime as defined in the current Electronic Communications and Transactions Act. As such, cybercrime is not a uniquely reported crime type with a universal definition to enable the determination of the extent of cybercrime through crime statistics. What I say, Honourable Chairperson and members, is we don't have crime codes at this point in time in the South African police on our systems to say this is the numbers of cybercrime that have been reported. These are reported as ordinary crimes to us, like ordinary fraud, theft, crimen injuria, whatever the case may be. That's what we're saying in the slide. Therefore, the full extent of cybercrime in the country is not supported at this point in time by crime statistics in numbers. We have some statistics on pure cybercrime that is regarded as cybercrime under the current Electronic Communications and Transactions Act of 2002. You will see from the period 2014-04 to 2015-03, 103 cases were reported to the police, 98 arrests were effected. Corresponding period in 2015 to 2016, 86 cases reported, 66 arrests. 2016-04 to 2017-03, 89 cases reported, 62 arrests effected. And in 2017-04 to 2017-12, 58 cases reported under that act as pure cybercrime and 47 number of arrests effected. Conclusion, Honourable Chairperson and members. We say that cybercrime is included in the South African Police Service National Risk Matrix. Cybercrime risk description is inadequate understanding of the nature and impact of cybercrime in the country, including inter alia the use of social networks in the perpetration of crime, and allocated to the National Head Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation as the national risk champion. Cybercrime has been declared an operational priority by the National Commissioner to be addressed through the National Crime Combating Forum and the National Crime Combating Strategy. The SAPS is already working on a comprehensive integrated operational cybercrime strategy that, where applicable, will be aligned with the provisions of the bill to give effect to it. And addressing cybercrime poses unique policing challenges and requires new policing practices, technology, and concentrated effort to address a threat to national security. I thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members.
Thank you very much, Brigadier Van Gaan. I want to take it for granted that all that is being presented has been engaged at the level of the, is it CRC you call it, where the departments are actually coming together, because my concern, for example, would be when you indicate that cost 45, for example, that it's problematic since it brings the NDPP into the domain of crime prevention, combating intelligence and investigation. I want to know whether you've already engaged on it and what conclusion have you reached so that the drafters are actually aware of it and they would then bring it forward as a recommendation. So that it should actually give us a feeling that the departments have engaged and they've come to certain understanding in terms of areas maybe of concern like this as to whether it does suit NPA in a manner in which you see it and to understand why in the first place when the bill was drafted. It was actually put that way. And also some of the areas that maybe would support would be what you refer to oral application, which is supposed to speed up your process, but at the same time whether there is no abuse as to whether you did look at whether there will not be any abuse because this is not clearly articulated as to how we're going to look at whether it's not abused or not. You don't have to respond now. I'm going to open up for members to ask questions. Members, questions and comments. Do you want to have all the presentations? Because what Honorable Bumlana was concerned about was that they will forget about what has been presented. By the time it comes to the end, maybe it will be too late. So you want us to go to the next presentation?
I think we should do the presentations, Chair.
Okay.
And this is what my colleagues, because we're running, time is very limited, and we might engage at length with the police, for example, and then the other institutions can't, there won't be time. We just need to be strict with time. So maybe we should receive all, because as Mr. Woodley said, they all add to the base document. So maybe we should receive all the presentations and then engage, Chair.
Okay, Honorable Swart, I think it's a valid suggestion. As long as the departments, when you present, it shouldn't be like you're just presenting for yourself. It should actually also indicate as to how a matter like Clause 45, how was it actually received by the CRC. Is that okay? We'll then get to the next presentation, which will be on from the Department of Telecommunications by Mr. Kiru Pile.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. I'm Kiru Pillay. I represent the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services, and I'm going to briefly run through the mandate of the department with respect to cybersecurity and maybe some progress that the Cybersecurity Hub has made in the past 2 years. So just some context, the Cybersecurity Hub is one of the four national CSERTs mandated by the NCPF in the bill. And at the risk of sounding competitive with my esteemed colleagues, I think it's probably one of the larger mandates with respect to the national CSERTs, because it's responsible for the private sector, and the private sector holds a lot of critical infrastructure, and it talks to banks and logistics and all of that. So a very large mandate with respect to the Cybersecurity Hub. And basically, the things we need to do is to act as a national point of contact for the coordination of cybersecurity incidents, to track those incidents, to mitigate those incidents, and to remediate those incidents. The Cybersecurity Hub is physically located at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. It was established in October 2015. It has been operational since then. And the nature of national CSERT is that there's a maturity model that national CSERTs need to go towards to become a fully fledged Cybersecurity Hub. With respect to that, we have technically looked at the kinds of services that a fully mature cybersecurity hub needs to deliver, and we've chosen some reactive services, some proactive services, and some other services that are in line with the NCPF mandate and in line with the mandate of the hub. So we do a lot of alerts and warnings, a lot of incident handling, vulnerability management, a lot of announcements in terms of threats and incidents, and a big mandate is awareness and education and training. And we'll unpack that a little bit. Looking back at the NCPF, if you look at Chapter 6 of the NCPF, it speaks specifically to what the Cybersecurity Hub has to do. And we've taken all of the statements and we've grouped them together, and what we've come up with is three main mandates, and that's sector search establishment, public-private partnerships, increasing collaboration, and coordinating threats at the national level and resolving. The second one is information dissemination, best practice guidelines, audit readiness, audits readiness exercises, and standards compliance. And the third one is cybersecurity awareness. So not a lot. At that point, you can laugh. Okay. I think Mr. Modley alluded to the fact that first membership is important to us because the transnational nature of cybersecurity means that we often have to engage with our counterparts in other countries. And first gives us that level of confidence that other national CSERTs are willing to engage with us. It tells them that apart from just being a member of FIRST, we've got processes in place, that our protocols are in place, and that our institutions are secure. So FIRST membership is fairly important to us. We're currently underway with all of the upgrades that need to be in place, and we are applying for FIRST in this financial year. We do a lot of incident management, so we give the public the opportunity to report cybersecurity threats and incidents to the cybersecurity hub. It is part of our mandate. It is something that we see as a diminishing mandate. It is, I think, in an ideal world, as the public becomes more familiar with the number of sector CISAs that are available, organizations like Sabric and that like, that incidents related to a specific sector will be reported to the sector. In the absence of those sector CISAs, we take on the responsibility for reporting those incidents and trying to resolve those incidents. So incidents, we get incidents and we monitor those incidents. We often have to route those incidents to the relevant sector. So we often deal with Brigadier Peterser, we often deal with the South African Banking Risk Information Center, and we route those incidents and we work with them to resolve those incidents. So the big banking incident that happened in 2016 with 300 million rand that was stolen from one of the big four banks, so we worked closely with Sabric on that, with crime intelligence, with Brigadier Peterser last year on the big data breach. So we report our incidents on a monthly basis to our department, on a quarterly basis, and we also have some annualized statistics that we think are important. And I think Brigadier van Kraan alluded to something that's very important. There's a serious lack of empirical data around cybersecurity. So you'll see a lot of people saying that we're the eighth most hacked, and last year we lost 2 billion rand. So in the absence of organizations being obligated to report those breaches, I'm not comfortable with those figures. So I think it's very important that we start looking at empirical data, and we've started looking at some exercises around that, which I will report on. In terms of sector CISAs, I think the strategy of both the bill and the policy framework is that the way to increase the threat posture in this country is via the sector CISAs. And sector CISAs, and I've unpacked the finance sector to probably just to illustrate more what sector CISAs are. So sector CISAs are organizations like Sabric, South African Banking Risk Information Center. So 19 banks are represented at Sabric, and collectively we are able to say that we are fairly comfortable the banking sector is fairly secure with respect to cybersecurity. They are exchanging threat information, they are exchanging awareness, they have a steering committee, they are well organized, and we can put a tick box and say that Sabric and the banking sector, we are comfortable that there is some progress with respect to cybersecurity. So that model needs to be replicated across all sectors. Now, instinctively, when you say a sector CISAT and you talk about finance, your first inclination is that one sector CISAT may be sufficient. But if you look at the finance sector, we have other sector CISATs like PASA, the Payments Association. We have the Associations of Savings and Investment. They're based down in Cape Town. We've got the Financial Markets, which is the JSE, Bank Serves Trade. So a single sector has multiple sector CISATs, and all of that combined then makes that sector mature. Now that model needs to be replicated across all of the other sectors. So conceivably, these sector CISAs, the numbers of these sector CISAs will increase dramatically in the next couple of years. Now currently the policy framework does not place an obligation on a sector to create a sector CISAT, right? So the approach of the cybersecurity hub is more carrot than stick, right, for lack of a better expression. However, when the bill is passed, there is then some obligation on a sector to create a sector CISAT, also known as a nodal point. We have made some progress in the establishment of sector CISAT. So apart from the finance sector, I think the higher education sector is well represented. They have an organization called SANRAN/TENET, which caters for all of the higher education sectors, some of the museums, some of the research councils. But the hub, we've managed to make some progress with the Consumer Goods Council and the Internet Service Providers Association. Again, in the absence of any obligation, this has been a difficult process. But the consumer goods sector and the mobile sector has shown some inclination towards the establishment of sector CISAs, and that goes a long way to making those sectors more safer. A big part of what we're going to be doing in the year ahead is obviously looking at how these sector CISOs can be cajoled and convinced into creating some kind of sector capability. In terms of improved consultation, we're a member of the CRC Secretariat and of the CRC Technical Committees, but we also have things like the National Cybersecurity Advisory Council, the National ICT Forum, all initiatives of the department to bring cybersecurity closer. I'm going to just quickly skip to that. One of the things in our mandate is the ability to respond to incidents very fairly quickly. So the incident I spoke about earlier around the Standard Bank attack, it was difficult to get coordination with respect to how we engage with that. That attack happened in Japan. It was a lot of Japanese nationals. So again, we had to interface with the Japanese ambassador. And what we thought we would do is create something called a war room or a response center, where we'd be able to coordinate the response to an incident quicker. So it probably sounds fancier than it is, but it's a piece of collaborative software where that's really secure. That if an incident does happen, I could then fire up the head of the CRC, the Japanese ambassador, and maybe not resolve at that particular point, but at least coordinate the resolution of. So that cybersecurity war room is in the process of being established at the cybersecurity hub. We are investigating the development of homegrown cybersecurity tools. So it sounds like a lofty exercise, but I think it's fairly important. The ability of a sector of a country to develop its own cybersecurity tools is very important. The issues of proprietary software from other countries doesn't always inspire confidence in those tools. So I think the CSIR and other organizations like DNEL are doing a lot of work around the development of these cybersecurity homegrown tools. It builds confidence in the sector. It has a spin-off of the development of the SME sector within that. So we're actively pursuing that. In terms of information dissemination, we rely heavily on the state security directives, which we then push out to our stakeholders. We also create our own directives around the WannaCry attack last year. We created our own directive fairly quickly, which we pushed out to our sectors. A lot of technical information was included in that around the IP addresses that needed to be looked out for. We have piloted a business intelligence solution at the Cybersecurity Hub, which has made enormous progress. We think this is a tool that can be developed in the next year to produce a South African-specific threat feed that we'd be able to say, these are the things that our sectors need to be look out for. We are working with the CSR, the modeling and design science people, and they produce some fairly nice images around how this BI tool and the kinds of information that is pushing out. So we're hoping in the next year to bring this project to fruition, and maybe with a little bit of luck we have our own kind of threat feed for South Africa. Many of the threat feeds that emerge from the proprietary sector, the Kasperskis of the world, are global in nature. But in terms of a South African threat feed, I think it's important that the incidents that we need to be cognizant of is catered for. This lack of empirical data, I think, is fairly important. So what we did last year is that we ran a survey, a fully statistically valid survey that we had validated prior, and it looks at a baseline understanding of where organizations are with respect to cybersecurity. It was a fairly extensive survey. We ran it for about 6 months. We are about ready to produce a report. And it looked at things like roles and responsibilities, cybersecurity strategies and plans. And we think that this is a nice baseline for us to understand where organizations are with respect to cybersecurity. And then we can make some evidence-based interventions based on that. So do sectors need a better understanding of the bill? Do sectors need a better understanding of the ecosystem of standards, which is sometimes very difficult to navigate? So that report's ready, and we'll be publishing that in the next couple of weeks. And a lot of cybersecurity is technical in nature, and there's a lot of standards that apply, and some of them are management type standards, some of them are more technical type standards. But we think it's important, and I think Mr. Modley alluded to the fact that everybody needs to understand what we are dealing with. So a malware needs to be a malware, it needs to be a malware. And those are embedded in standards, and we have developed and we are developing those standards, which we are now trying to socialize, and we hope that they will become national standards along the lines of MIS and MISP, which organizations will take on board. all presentations prior to this and probably subsequent will talk to the skills issue. We believe that the skills issue, so universities are offering a lot of kind of courses, and I think that's aimed at C-level type managers. There's lots of technical information, but there's a need to massify this training. So we need a lot of pen testers, and we need a lot of people who can do the basic hacking skills, and we think that the CTARs are probably the right way to go. So we found a framework called the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education. It's a U.S. framework developed by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We modified that for South Africa. We socialized that with 11 of the CTARs. We're now ready to, I think, move that aggressively forward this year. So hopefully that there is a skills framework in place, and then we can start looking at how we develop curricula around this. So that's been taken aboard by both SABRIC and the bank CTARs, socialized with about 10 other CTARs, and again, we're going to aggressively push that this year. Awareness is a huge initiative for us, a mandate for us, and it's awareness both for the sector CISOs in terms of technical information, but it's also awareness to the public on how they can protect themselves. So we developed a national cybersecurity awareness portal, which we launched last year. So we believe that this portal will become the main conduit for cybersecurity awareness training programs. We believe awareness is a shared responsibility, so we've engaged with the likes of the Film and Publications Board, the SABRIC, so that, and banks, so that all kinds of awareness information for the public will be via our cybersecurity awareness portal. And again, it's been developed by CETA, it's live, and this year it's more around developing content for cybersecurity awareness. We are looking at translation programs, so all of the content on there is translated into all of the official languages. We are looking at things like hackathons so that universities can get more involved and digital artifacts can be developed. And I think that's it. Madam Chair, thank you.
Of the SCCU strategic objectives. That's why I brought Advocate Governor here. She is the one who's going to take us through the presentation. I have noted, Chair, that in the invitation we were invited to come and brief the committee specifically in relation to our obligations and roles in terms of the 24/7 point of contact, as well as highlight our current capacity and capacity building initiatives on cybercrime and cybersecurity. So the slides show that we'll touch on the 24/7 clause. We'll expand on our state of readiness in terms of trained personnel, and we'll take you through a brief synopsis of our operational data and statistics from 2011 to date. And maybe at the appropriate time, we may comment on the remarks made by the other presenters, like the issue about MLAs that came from the SSA presentation and the issues around the Clause 24 on standard operating procedures, as well as the issues around section of Clause 45.1 that were raised by SAPS, but we will get to those at the appropriate time during questions. Over to you, Malini.
Thank you very much. Good morning, or good afternoon. The structure of our presentation, as Adkiram Zignati has taken us through so far, will deal with what our mandate is, especially in light of the brief that we were given, how we deal with the prosecution of cyber crimes, our performance information, as indicated, some comments in respect of the bill. I think it must be noted, firstly, that you know the NPA's role and in fighting cybercrime actually predates the coming into operation of the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework, which was gazetted in December of 2015. The NPA as a starting point operated a point of contact, 24 point of contact under the auspices of the DSO, which then migrated to the DPCI in 2009. We will note that from the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework, particularly with regard to Clause 16, it indicates that the NPA, together with DOJ, has the overall responsibility to facilitate cybercrime prosecutions and court processes in accordance with applicable law. 16.3 deals with SAP's responsibility for crime prevention, investigation, combat, and combating of cybercrime in the Republic. They're also responsible for the maintaining of a specialized investigative capacity and interaction with international and national stakeholders. Now, within this context, it must be noted that the NPA's role is wider than just the prosecution of these cybercrime cases. By virtue of the nature of our specialist units that we have within the NPA, the fact that we have to have a dedicated capacity, especially within the SECU, that deals with some of these matters, and what it is that we are required to do in terms of guiding investigations, we play a critical role in respect of the activities where SAPS is concerned, especially where it concerns the investigation of cybercrime. So we also, within this context, when SAPS are approached with informal requests for assistance from foreign jurisdictions, we give guidance, we give assistance in terms of the legal prescripts, and also when it then has to be converted into a formal mutual legal assistance execution, that is where the NPA becomes critically involved in dealing with the matters. We also, and you'll note from Clause 11 of the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework, that we are required to promote local as well as international cooperation. Now, this clause is of general application. It states that it focuses on collaboration with the private sector, collaboration with relevant and appropriate international organizations, governments, and regional fora. And as such, the NPA has consistently over the years participated on various bodies, particularly with regard to GLACI, which is that arose as a result of the Budapest Convention, the IAP's Global Prosecutors Electronic Network, which is the network by virtue of which we give informal as well as formal assistance, where training is also dealt with, as well as the sharing of best practices. And then finally, the Intergovernmental Expert Group on Cybercrime. One of the concerns that we have is that there isn't actually an international instrument that deals with how we, in fact, organize ourselves as an international community. There's various regional instruments, and that intergovernmental group is focused on ensuring that we are in a position to try and get something in place, and South Africa is championing that process through chairing that committee as well. So moving forward, we are hopeful that on an international stage, we will finally have an instrument that governs how cybercrime is dealt with. Now, within this context, I think it's important to note which of the units within the NPA deal with cybercrime. And as a starting point, I want to also emphasize that the NPA actually defines cybercrime very widely. In our annual performance plan, we look at cybercrime as any crime that is facilitated by the use of information technology. So information technology can either be the subject of cybercrime, colleagues have mentioned attacks that occur, or else it actually can be an enabler of cybercrime. And what we found within our space is more often than not you find that traditional crimes, or crimes that you would encounter in any event, whether it's crimininuria, whether it is going to be something in respect of fraud, it's actually the use of information technology that has caused these crimes to be dealt with differently. However, there are crime types that are dealt with, and we note the comments from SAPS with regard to why some crime types now have a cyber flavor to it, whereas other crime types are not mentioned. The reality is information technology can find its application in any crime type that there is, and we must be mindful of that. So the business units within the NPA that are seized with cybercrime, firstly, our priority crimes litigation unit. Mandate within the conspectus of their mandate, they would focus on your cybersecurity and cyber terrorism matters. So your infrastructure offences would probably be dealt with by the PCLU. An interesting area that is gaining a lot of recognition and a lot of work internationally is the aspect of terror financing and terror recruitment, the use of social media. So this is a critical space where the PCLU has been playing a role insofar as cybercrime is concerned. Then within the NPA, the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit, we focus on the economic offences predominantly. Now, much of the, and especially when we mentioned the ECT offences, a lot of your card crime, a lot of your banking crime matters are matters that would find application and would be focused on by the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit. We've also, as a result of our focus areas, looked at denial of services attacks as well as intrusive attacks, particularly in the private sector. Intrusive attacks involving the government sector would predominantly be dealt with by the PCLU, but when you are looking at companies that find themselves victims of domain takeovers or hacking, that is where it is that we would become involved as the SECU. Then under general prosecutions, you'll find that your child pornography and related offences, as well as any other offence involving the use of information technology. Of particular note, in the Western Cape last year, they started a case that was called the Facebook murder case, where victims were actually sourced via Facebook, and evidence was led as to how it is the perpetrator actually found his victims, as well as the linkages that they were to find him at a specific IP, and then IP address that then was taken through to a home address, leading to his arrest. It's important to look at what is our capacity. Are we sufficiently ready to deal with the cybercrime threats that are coming our way? We recognize that cybercrime is something that is constantly evolving, and it's necessary for us to ensure that we keep ourselves updated. But the NPA recognized already in around 2010, and by 2010 we started in our annual performance plan putting in targets with regard to cybercrime. We also started looking at dedicated focus, especially within the specialized commercial crime units, to deal with cybercrime, but more importantly, how it is that we could improve the picture, the footprint of all prosecutors in dealing with cybercrime. So we together with Justice College looked at first and foremost developing an entry level cybercrime program and then a more advanced cybercrime program. So that is the numbers that you have since 2011. We've got 626 prosecutors who were trained in respect of the general cybercrime course. 27 attended an advanced cybercrime course that was run by Justice College. Justice College in around 2013 decided that rather than having two separate courses, that, and as a result of the numbers of prosecutors that had already been trained, as well as the service delivery improvement plan that the SECU started implementing, that it was no longer necessary to differentiate between an entry level and an advanced cybercrime course. They now run only one cybercrime course that is on a yearly basis updated with the developments and trends. The SECU then, through its service delivery improvement plan, takes the responsibility for ensuring that there's some awareness as well as training for prosecutors at an entry level of what cybercrime is and how to deal with cybercrime case or cases involving cybercrime. But these are generally your very, very minor offences. It's more about where it is a computer system has been or IT technology is actually an enabler to another crime as opposed to your more complex matters. We also realized that within this conspectus we needed something a bit more than what Justice College was offering. There was a partnership together with the University of Pretoria, as a result of which we had 50 SECU prosecutors trained and 24 from the general prosecution section. So currently what we have is 20 dedicated prosecutors within the SECU and one in the PCLU who deals with the cyber terrorism aspects, the recruitment financing aspects. The 20 SECU prosecutors deal with various aspects. Firstly, dealing with those complex matters within the SECU involving cybercrime. They're also responsible for training, mentorship, guiding investigations in other areas. So, for example, with regard to that Facebook matter, the dedicated prosecutor in the Western Cape was approached for advice as to how to convert the evidence, how to approach Facebook, the subpoenas that needed to be put in place, the MLA, and so forth. And as a result, we give that type of guidance to prosecutors in the general stream. Training initiatives that are ongoing that we don't report upon necessarily the numbers, but we can provide. SOCA has got a dedicated program that deals with child pornography. So just about every single prosecutor that is dealing with any type of sexual offense would have at some stage have to undergo this training. And as indicated, the specialized commercial crime unit through its service delivery improvement plan is looking at how it is that we can improve the skills level on for the general detectives as well as for prosecutors in the other courts. In terms of our performance, I think that we, as I stated, we started in around 2010 with trying to develop the skills, trying to see how it is that we are in a position to address what it is that we were finding already existed in the environment and keep up with developments that there were. So you can see that year on year there has been an improvement in terms of the NPA's performance. Now I must say that these figures speak to not just the commercial crime unit, but also general prosecutions, and there's sharing of targets that are set between the specialist prosecutors as well as the general prosecutors. One of the reasons why is we found that initially the DPCI dealt with a large majority of the cases that would qualify as cybercrime because of their mandate becoming strict as it was, and the focus on very high-level crime. A lot of these cases then migrated into the detective services. So we've had to ensure that there was a balance between both the specialist units that can deal with the high-level commercial cybercrime, as well as ensuring that those matters that reside with the detective services get the necessary attention through the prosecutors. So as a result of the various training efforts that we've had in place together with the detectives and the prosecutors, we've seen that it's actually the general prosecution sections that's overtaking the specialist units in terms of finalizations. The positive aspect of this is that the conviction rate is still high. So as a result, and that shows that at the end of the day, those cases that we do in fact prosecute are ones where the investigations are conducted in a manner that allows us to be able to prove these cases beyond a reasonable doubt. What we're also seeing from the figures is that there's an increase. There's obviously an increase in terms of the cases that are being reported, even though there isn't a strict classification by the police in terms of what is cybercrime. But there certainly is an increase because there's an increased focus area by both the police as well as prosecution. So the figures are increasing year on year. We understand that we will have the opportunity tomorrow to engage more effectively on the cybercrime bill. We've also heard the comments that have been made by our colleagues in the police, and we'll go through those. But we thought for the purposes of this presentation, just to highlight a few aspects that we thought was quite important going forward. And particularly with impacts upon the capacity within the NPA. Now, the first aspect that we thought was of material importance was to talk about the 24/7 point of contact. In terms of Clause 50 of the bill, we're required to make members of the NPA who have particular knowledge, skills, and skills in respect of any aspect dealt with in the bill, who have a security clearance issued by the SSA. Now, we wanted to bring to the attention of the committee that 17F of the SAPS Act requires us to provide a dedicated capacity of prosecutors to the DPCI. So one of the questions was it really necessary to legislate upon this in the fashion that it was, as a result of the fact that we do have this obligation already in terms of the Act. The practice is, in any event, that there is a capacity of dedicated prosecutors who are available to the police to provide whatever guidance and assistance is required. So it's never been a case that we felt that it was necessary to legislate upon this point. So we do have that capacity, as indicated, to fill the functions of guiding investigations and prosecuting cases. What we will have to understand is what our role and function would have to be within the intelligence space. Now, clearly, from a prosecution point, we've always been very careful about ensuring that we stick within the mandate that is required of us, and equally so going forward where this is concerned, if it is required that this 24.7 point of contact is to be maintained, our role and function with regard to guidance in that intelligence space will have to be more clearly defined, as it's an area that is not one that the NPA normally engages on. Equally so, we saw that NPA personnel need to be vetted by SSA. It's a general requirement that NPA personnel are expected to be vetted. The question was, why does this have to be legislated upon? There's no other act that we have that requires vetting of personnel to be legislated upon. So the question was, what was the rationale? Why specifically this act? Especially when one considers some of the other very material acts that there are, issues around terrorism, by way of example, where such issues are not dealt with. Equally, we also looked at what the current position is internationally with regard to a 24/7 point of contact. This 24/7 point of contact was actually something that was introduced by the Budapest Convention. There is no mention of it in the AU Convention on Cybercrime. So the rationale towards why it is we should have a 24/7 point of contact legislated upon was questioned. We noted that there was only two countries internationally that have legislated upon this, and that was Portugal and Romania. And if one looks at the cybercrime footprint, successes, best practices, these two countries are not countries that have contributed markedly for us to be in a position to say, okay, with regard to this 24 point of contact, and especially the role of the National Prosecuting Authority in that, that yes, in fact, it amounts to a best international best practice that can be supported. We noted as well in terms of the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework that the authority responsible for cross-border law enforcement cooperation is in fact SAPS. Now, the current situation is that we do give guidance and assistance to SAPS when they ask us anything as it relates to what it is that they can provide. It was not necessary for them to have this legislation. And the point made by my colleague with regard to police cooperation and the introduction of the National Director of Public Prosecutions into that space is one that needs to be engaged upon more fully, because we are in support. The rationale for that happening and adding a further layer to law enforcement cooperation is one of concern, especially when you have to operate in this environment that requires almost immediate responses if you want to deal with crime prevention. So once again, we also dealt with what it is that their responsibilities were in keeping with the SAPS Act, that's 17F, as well as the support that we provide by the GPEN network of prosecutors. So equally so, our role and function within this 24/7 point of contact, we looked at possibly more from the point of an intelligence aspect as opposed to the law enforcement aspect. If it is within the context of the law enforcement aspect, then we are already currently performing those functions that are necessary within that space. Then a few other things that we thought perhaps we need to cover. The Cybersecurity Bill, Chapter 1, Clause 1, deals with the definition of data and data traffic. Now, I don't want to go into detail of it, but what we noted, and this perhaps will be discussed further tomorrow, is that the two aspects that were actually not covered, which we felt perhaps needs to be considered. The question was whether or not data was wide enough to cover content data. So content data, likewise, would be, for example, your email communications, what it is that was found, the indirect communications mentioned by my colleague from SAPS. We noted specifically excluded from this is issues around subscriber data. Now, subscriber data that is held by an internet service provider and or an electronic communications provider is material information required for the purposes of investigations and prosecutions. This information can assist us with regard to the identity of the persons, the geographical locations, addresses, issues around billing information, payment information, the nature of the services provided and used, which all go into the mix into building up a criminal case. against a potential suspect. So we found that this information, perhaps by limiting it to data and data traffic, is one that is excluded, and because of the exclusion, we may have challenges when we apply, for example, for search warrants and or we apply for Section 205 subpoenas relating to such information. And then lastly, the issue with regard to the powers to investigate, search, and access or seize. We looked at the standing operating procedures as well, and of concern to us is what has been raised by SAPS. The reality of the matter is SAPS have got standard operating procedures about just about every function that there is. If they're dealing with analysis of forensic material, DNA, there's a standard operating procedure. We do not provide that information. We do not legislate upon that. We do not issue that out. We do not gazette that information. So what was the rationale, once again, for wanting something as material as how it is you go about investigating to be put into the public space in this fashion? Clause 25 renders the application of the CPA. Our question was, has the time not come for the CPA to be, when it comes to search and seizures, to actually be amended? The reality of the matter is we do not want to find ourselves in a situation where you have to, for an object-based search, rely on the CPA and the provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act, but in order to access the information held on the object, you now need to use the provisions of the Cybersecurity Bill. So surely the time has come where we need to look at the provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act, recognize that at the end of the day, we need to have it broadened to include data, searching for data, and so forth. The point made by my learned colleague about whether or not you now need to, for example, the opportunity where you arrest somebody, you find a device in their possession, but now you have to get a search warrant in order to access that information, is one that is well made. Practically, the implications of that mean that we have to have two separate processes, and I think that actually makes law enforcement less effective rather than effective in these circumstances. And then the aspect that we wondered about is, within this space, it's not necessarily an object-based search that is the most effective. Where you are dealing with real-time investigations, the opportunity to do a remote search, for example, if somebody is hacking a server that is in another jurisdiction in the country, surely in respect of the, and the person or the search that is to be conducted is conducted in the Western Cape. How do we deal with issues around remote searches? Do we deal with it under RICA as interceptions? But surely this is something that is just not unpacked sufficiently in the bill, and the need for remote searches, if one has to be effective in the fight against cybercrime, is one that needs to be looked at and addressed. And we felt that the bill did not go far enough in order to deal with this aspect more clearly. In fact, seems absolutely silent on this issue. And if you do not have something in place that deals with that aspect, you, in fact, are not really moving far enough forward in respect of dealing with cybercrime effectively. Okay, those were... Thank you.
Thank you very much to the NPA. Zerko will be next.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. Allow me to introduce my team. Next to me is Advocate Doc Mashabane. He's the Chief Director, Multilateral Political at the United Nations. Immediately behind me is Advocate Andre Smit. He's the State Law Advisor in OXLA. DIRCO has its own OXLA division. And next to him is Mr. Lunga Bengu. He's in the Directorate Transnational Organized Crime. The two gentlemen seated at the back are members in my office, Mr. Eric Rafahlema and Mr. Zaire Amin. My name is Llewellyn Landers. I'm the Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation and a former member of this portfolio committee, so it's with some pleasure that I am addressing you today, Chairperson. My task today is twofold. Firstly, you asked us to, with specific reference to Chapter 6 and Chapter 12, to tell you whether the bill in its current form impacts on DIRCO's mandate and functions. In their current form, Chapter 6 and Chapter 12 do not impact on DIRCO's mandate and functions. Now, the second part of your request asked us to highlight existing and planned capacity to deal with issues that might emanate from the bill. And several presentations have referred to the fact that presently there is no international legally binding instrument to which all countries can agree to. Reference has been made to the Budapest Convention, which was agreed to in 2001, and South Africa was a signatory to the Budapest Convention. Unfortunately, and this is typical of all things, the Budapest Convention was put forward by the European Union, and when member states of the convention got together to meet in Europe, they turned around and said to us, "You are not European, you are South African." And so we were not invited, and hence as a consequence of that and for other reasons, we have since withdrawn from the Budapest Convention. There is the AU Convention, and we have instructed our team to ascertain why, after 3 years, because it came about in 2014, why South Africa has not signed and or ratified the AU Convention on these matters. And we hope to come back to you with a response in that regard. And so, Chair, as has been noted by other presenters, South Africa is chair of the open-ended intergovernmental expert group on cybercrime, which has met on several occasions. An agreement on several issues has been reached, in particular a resolution extending the mandate of the eminent group to allow for the continuation of discussions on the challenges of cybercrime. South Africa is also working with BRICS partners and other interested parties to ensure that a legally binding international instrument is developed. We want to use this opportunity, Chairperson, to plead with colleagues and people in this House to appeal to their political masters and principles to put pressure on DIRCO to ensure that this comes about. Your doing that actually arms us. Otherwise, DIRCO has a strange way of doing things. It lopes along very casually until pressure is put on it. So we're appealing to all of you, including this portfolio committee chairperson, so that we can take this up in the relevant forum. I may just add that the major powers, United States of America, France, Russia, China, and such like, are opposed to such a convention or international treaty for reasons that don't make sense to you and me, but all they've said is it's not necessary. But we've overcome these difficulties in the past, and I'm sure that we will do so again in this case. And so we're appealing to you to please lean on your political principles so they in turn can lean on my minister, who in turn can lean on the rest of us in DIRCO, and we can raise this matter in the appropriate forum, and then hopefully an international instrument can be brought about. Madam Chair, this is the sum total of my address to you today, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Honourable Lenders, for the DIRCO presentation. Can we have defense?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and honorable members. I'm Major General Bonkosi Ngcobo. Next to me is Major General Shingange. It's Major Shingange. He's the Staff Officer Class 2, Cyber Security. And on the extreme right, there's a lady who's sitting on her own there. That's Advocate Nandi Panzaluba, also from the defense, involved also in the project of developing a cyber command. Firstly, I would like to perhaps give an indication of our understanding of what we were expected to do. Firstly, it is our understanding that we are expected to address the issue of the mandate of the SANDF in terms of the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework, and also to look at the issue of the roles and responsibilities allocated to the South African National Defense Force in terms of the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill. Furthermore, we were expected to indicate steps that have been taken to give effect to the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill, perhaps more specifically the issue of the current capacity to deal with cybersecurity, as well as capacity building within capacity building initiatives within the South African National Defense Force, and the issue of compliance with Clause 54(3) of the bill, and also to indicate what existing plans, what existing initiatives and plans are in place relating to cybersecurity. To execute this task given to us, we have identified certain topics that are going to address in our scope. Firstly, we are going to look at the issue of the Constitution of the Republic and what it says with regards to the mandate of the South African National Defense Force. Furthermore, we will look also into what the National Cybersecurity Policy Framework says in terms of the roles and responsibilities of the South African National Defense Force. And then we also looked at the roles of the Department of Defense flowing from the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill, in this case, the 2017 version. We also looked at made comparisons between what is stated in the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill 2017 and also the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill 2015. We also looked at the issue of the provisions of the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill with respect to the national critical information infrastructure. This may perhaps be seen to be something outside the mandate of the Defense Force, but we felt that we need to point out whatever concerns we may have in that regard. Similarly, also the relationship between the national critical information the stipulations of the bill in terms of the national critical information infrastructure vis-a-vis what the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill says. And then also we would indicate the existing and planned initiatives relating to cybersecurity. And lastly, we would make recommendations. The Constitution of South Africa, Section 202, states that the primary objective of the Defense Force is to defend and protect the Republic, its territorial integrity, and its people, in accordance with the Constitution and the principles of international law regulating the use of force. And I'm emphasizing the term force. We then find that the DoD mandate finds expression in five distinctive domains, that is the land, the sea, the air, the outer space, as well as the cyberspace. Now, in terms of the mandate of the SANDF, as it derives from the Constitution, the part that relates to the principles of international law regulating the use of force, to us, is a bit of a concern in the sense that when it comes to the cyber security, cyber warfare, cyber defense, and so on, there is no clarity on what constitutes force in the context of cyber warfare across all these five domains. And this notwithstanding the existing Italian framework development. In terms of the National Security Policy Framework, we looked at paragraph 13.1 under subtopic cyber warfare, which states, in order to protect its interests in the event of cyber war, a cyber defense capacity has to be built. The NCPF thus promotes a cyber defense strategy. The NCPF thus promotes a cyber defense strategy that is informed by the National Security Strategy of South Africa be developed, guided by the JCPS Cyber Security Response Committee. We feel that the NCPF provision defines the mandate of the DoD narrowly. In this regard, we are saying that it addresses itself only to the issue of, you know, developing a cyber defense capacity in the event of a cyber war. But there are instances of cyber crime, which is not necessarily part of cyber war, and cyber espionage, which again may not necessarily be perceived as part of cyber war. And we also feel that perhaps there's also no clarity as to what defines or how do we define cyber war as opposed to cyber warfare. We make a distinction between cyber warfare and cyber war. Cyber war being the states of conflict in which techniques and tactics that fall under this warfare would be applied, you know, between the hostile countries or the hostile entities. So in this regard, we feel that perhaps some clarity maybe is needed here. Maybe one may venture to say on paragraph 13.1, the part that says, in order to protect its interest in the event of a cyber war, perhaps if maybe we could say something like, in order to protect its interest against cyber attacks. You don't necessarily have to be at war to be attacked, whether you're responding or not. But amongst other things, we feel also that we may perhaps want to argue that currently, you know, internationally, all countries are currently in a state of war when it comes to cyber, you know, warfare. The problem here is countries may not even be aware that they're being attacked. And the absence, we say here, the absence of casualties may not imply the absence of attacks. So the fact that you don't necessarily see casualties may not imply that you're not being attacked. In terms of the roles of the DoD flowing from the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill, we feel that the roles of the DoD have undergone extensive revision from the 2015 version of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill to that of the 2017 version, and we feel that this impacts our ability to conduct an appreciation of the readiness of the DoD. The 2017 version, clause 54.3a, states that the cabinet member responsible for the defense must, one, establish and maintain a cyber offensive and defensive capacity as part of the defense mandate of the South African National Defense Force, and I must apologize that there should have been at least three dots to indicate that there's text that follows there, which we omitted. And we then jumped to Roman figure 2, and in cooperation with any institution of higher learning in the Republic or elsewhere, develop and implement accredited training programs for members of the South African National Defense Force in order to give effect to sub-paragraph 1. But then also, there's a part of the clause that says, you know, establish and maintain sufficient human and operational capacity, and it goes on. We noted that this particular sentence is addressed under SSA, but it's also addressed under the police, South African Police Service. When it comes to defense, this particular aspect has been omitted. And when it comes to the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill 2015, we noted that clause 55 has been removed in the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill 2017, but reduced to subparagraph 3 of subparagraph 3 of paragraph 54, of clause 54. Clause 55 in the 2015 bill stated that the cabinet member responsible for defense must, in consultation with the cabinet member responsible for national financial matters, A, establish a cyber command, and we emphasize the part cyber command, as part of the intelligence division of the South African National Defense Force, contemplated in section 33 of the Defense Act 2002, Act 42 of 2002, and equip, operate, and maintain the cyber command. There are quite a number of other sub-paragraphs that have been omitted. We are perhaps maybe less concerned with some, but we didn't want to list all the aspects of clause 55. And we note that this part has been omitted. We would appreciate that especially emphasis on the cyber command as part of the intelligence division of the South African National Defense Force be brought back. As I indicated earlier, that we also made observations that may be perceived to be perhaps beyond the mandate of the Defense Force, but we felt that it should be important that we bring this to the attention of the Portfolio Committee. And this relates to the critical information infrastructure. We sort of made a comparison, you know, between aspects of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill and also aspects of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. And in this regard, specifically Clause 9 of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill and Clause 57 of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. And here we felt that something perhaps may have, or rather needed to be done before perhaps we reach this particular point. Amongst others, being the ability to identify the critical information infrastructure that we have to protect. So some kind of an audit of what exactly it is that we need to defend and protect. This, we feel, would enable a much more accurate appreciation of capabilities that need to be developed. And I'm not talking now at a broader level. When it gets to specifics, what exactly is it that we need to protect and defend. This would enable us to plan perhaps much, much better. And we find that also there are possible conflicts between the critical information in infrastructure as listed in the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill and the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. Here, in this regard, we note that Clause 9, 4A, of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill states that in the event that the infrastructure referred to in an application partly consists of, incorporates, or houses any possible information infrastructure, the National Commissioner must before making any recommendations to the Council, as contemplated in subsection 3C, refer the application to the Cyber Response Committee. Now, when we note, we highlight that the first that the application must be referred to the Cyber Response Committee. Whereas, in terms of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill, Clause 57(1), which states that the State Security Agency, in consultation with the Cyber Response Committee, and after consultation with the owner or the person in control of any information infrastructure, which is identified as a potential critical information infrastructure. The point being made here is that the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill does not say that the Cyber Response Committee, but it says the SSA in consultation with the Cyber Response Committee. When you go to the Critical Infrastructure Bill, it expects that the National Commissioner should engage the Cyber Response Committee, not directly the SSA. And then we also looked at, in terms of the existing and planned initiatives relating to cybersecurity, some aspects of this we believe would have come out from the joint presentation that has been presented earlier. But then we wanted to just highlight quite a few. That cybersecurity and defense in Daba has been planned to take place soon. And the purpose thereof will be to establish consensus on the thrust of the cyber defense strategy. Perhaps one should have started by indicating that we have developed a cyber defense strategy, but we felt that perhaps it should be tabled at this cybersecurity and defense endeavor for their further guidance, after which it will then be tabled at the Cyber Response Committee for further guidance also. Once approved by the Cyber Security and Defense Center. Also, the purpose will be to further refine Clause 55 of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill 2015, which, as indicated, has partly been omitted in the 2017 version. Also, the intention will be to conduct an appreciation of the resource implication flowing from Clause 55. The NCPF expects defense to establish a cyber command. This suggests that we will have to conduct an appreciation, a detailed appreciation, in terms of the resources that will be needed to establish a full capacity in this regard. So this will also give us some guidance. Amongst other things, also the purpose is to sponsor the amendment clause, the amended Clause 54(3) regarding the mandate of the DoD and its role in promoting cybersecurity, as well as to identify areas that require amendments to existing legislation upon which defense mandate rests, as well as those that require regulation for implementation of sub-clause 54(3). And also lastly, to conduct an organizational cyber defense readiness audit in terms of the skills and competencies. Here we're saying we need to, and perhaps I might wish to draw us back to the statement made earlier on, that an audit of the critical information infrastructure that has to be protected may need to be conducted. In this instance, additional to that, we need to conduct within the Department of Defense a skills audit and competencies in terms of, you know, cybersecurity. How many people do we have with qualifications that are related to cybersecurity, so that we can maybe draw from such a reserve. Amongst others, the issue of the existing capacities within the defense vote that is beyond just the SANTF only. We would like to make the following recommendations, given the fact that nowadays almost everything starts with a hashtag. We felt that perhaps we should also say hashtag bring back clause 55. And then that's our recommendation. We would really appreciate that, you know, a consideration be made to bring back aspects of clause 55. Secondly, also, the respect of the constitutional mandate as part of the boundary management and accountability. Here, we are referring to such institutions as the Auditor General of South Africa, the Information Regulator in terms of POPIA, etc. We feel that some aspects of the bill may perhaps be encroaching or maybe not recognizing that we have in existence certain institutions given specific mandates. So we feel that the bill needs to take into account that kind of reality. And then also another recommendation has to do with the alignment of the provisions dealing with the critical infrastructure as provided for in the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill, as well as those that are that relate to critical infrastructure but covered under the Critical Information Infrastructure Critical Information Infrastructure under Clause 57 of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. Apologies for that additional protection that shouldn't have been there. On that note, we end our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Major General Ngobo. Members, it's time for questions and comments. And I think, like we've actually agreed at the beginning, we'll just ask questions to all the departments that have presented all at once, and then they will then respond to the questions that we're going to be posing. And of course, we will expect the state security right at the end to actually then manage also to respond to also the presentations of the departments and the questions that you have been posed to you. Honorable Lenders, Deputy Minister of International Relations, is only with us until 13 hours, because we've got a 13:30 appointment. So we will give you the first opportunity to respond if you're still around after the members have actually posed questions and comments. Over to you, members. I'm advised it's 1 o'clock already, so maybe what I'm asking you to do is impossible. You released Honorable Lenders. Thank you. Members, over to you. Any questions, comments? Honorable Horn?
Chair, may I ask just a point of procedure? Will the Department of Justice, still while the departments is here, also respond to the issues they raised in respect of how the bill now reads?
I think it's quite appropriate because they are like the coordinators in terms of drafting. Over to you, members, for questions and comments. Honourable Breitenbach, to be followed by Honourable Ngau, and then to be followed by Honourable Pumlwana, Honourable Maila, Honourable Horn.
My question is firstly to the NPA. Perhaps Perhaps Advocate Govender can help me. Challenges exist with regards to remote searches. What are these specifically, and can they be catered for as interception under RICO? I'd like a little bit more detail on that, please. And then you mentioned that Justice College has the capacity to present cybercrime courses. Is this in-house capacity, or do they make use of external presenters, and if so, from where are they sourced? Then my next question is to the police. Civil claims against the police have increased exponentially over the years. How do you plan to mitigate this, especially with regards to claims against the private people that you're going to be using to assist? Who will be liable for the actions of these people? And then to justice. There is no overarching definition of cybercrime or cybersecurity that I've been able to find here. Can this be achieved, and is it perceived as necessary? Also to justice, has this bill been costed, and if so, is that available for us to have a look at? And we'd also like to have a look at a detailed implementation plan. Also to justice, could you elaborate a little on the need to create statutory offences for existing common law crimes? And then also to justice, section 16.1 of RICO provides for applications to intercept communications to be considered by a designated judge. Is there currently a designated judge? And in reply to a parliamentary question I posed last year, it's very clear that section 16.1 is hardly ever used, but that section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act is being abused to gain access to metadata, particularly with regards to cellular telephones. Is this being considered? How are you going to address this? And why is RICO not used? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mwangwa.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to honorable members and the departments, various departments here. Chair, I'm Honorable Mwabe. That's a correction on that one. If my mother can come
in. Thanks for the correction, Honorable Mwabe.
Yes. There are just few concerns, Chairperson. Listening to the presentations, some are worrying, especially when I was listening on the SAPS presenting. You get a sense, Chair, that the SAPS is not that much ready. Should this bill be signed into act? But I will have one question for the presenter from the SAPS. Because as he was presenting, I managed to pick up some few confusions. With the Criminal Procedure Act in its current form, will it be possible for the SAPS to execute all the tasks containing the bill as it contained now? That will be my first question to the SAPS Chair. To the state, to the Defence Force, when General Ngobo was presenting, I wasn't sure whether he's presenting the position of the Defence Force as it is, or maybe the position of the unit of the DI, the Defence Intelligence of the Defence Force. I want a clarity on that, and also as to, from the defense side, what is the role or has been the role of specifically the defense intelligence in the whole process when this the bill was formulated? Because I understand that they have a particular role which is specifically related to what we are talking about. We all know, Chair, that these days and in the future, wars will be fought through cyber. Now, that is when we need our, not just defense force, but defense intelligence will give us those early warnings to be well equipped and well understand this concept of cybersecurity. Well, I was going to ask the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, of what? Cooperative International Affairs. Yes, International Relations. Their relationship with the certain countries or the AU. Well, he says something, but I wanted to hear more. I understand, Chair, in Zimbabwe, that the way they are taking cyber issues so serious, they've establish, if I'm correct, the Ministry of Cyber Security. And I think the current President Mnangagwa is appointed one of cabinet ministers to be responsible for cyber. Now, I wanted to check with the deputy, but anyone can answer from the panelists. Can't we learn something from the new President of Zimbabwe? To the SSA, the presenter spoke about private, public, private partnerships, which to me was very interesting. But I want to hear more on your relationship with private security companies. You know, Chair, those people are very advanced than, more than us, the government, even the equipment they have. But also they can be a threat to the same state security on the ammunition they have. I'm told they have guns that we do not have as the government. And some of those private-owned companies, Chair, are foreign-owned. They have head offices in other countries. Some are only registered here, but they are operating in other countries. Now, in terms of this kind of job we are talking about, how is your relationship with them? Have you managed to bring them closer? Because if you are loose there, really, because they are not accountable to anyone, I thought we'll have Sira here representing them, saying something. So I want to know from the position of the SSA, what is your relationship with them? Lastly, Chair, I think this one will go to telecommunications. Or anyone can respond. Well, someone as was presenting indicated that if you speak of cyber, say security or cyber crime, it starts from my cell phone. You can go to computers and everything. Now, I want to know your readiness, or how will you deal with the ever upgrading cell phone industry. You know, we'll have this app today, tomorrow we'll have another app, to monitor me. Now we have a WhatsApp spy. There's a lot that they are doing to upgrade. Now, as the entities, how ready are we in terms of those upgrades? Well, some of the view that somehow it will end up catching us. If we are not ready. But Chair, the very last point, I think the NPA to me reflected a state of total readiness for cyber crimes as they were presenting. The reason why I'm saying that, when they were speaking about the training of prosecutors, to me it means they are ready. But the worry that I picked up, once we have a well-trained prosecutor who understands the concept, we've been going on trainings, but we have an ignorant practicing attorney in terms of the scope of the cyber, somehow we'll have a problem in terms of giving fair justice to our people. I'm not saying it's our people will be found guilty of, but I'm saying Once we have a ready NPA who understand the concept, then we have a practicing attorney, Ngwabe and Ngwabe, incorporated, who knows nothing about cyber security or cyber-related crimes. At some stage, our people will be victims, even if they were not supposed to be. So I'm meaning to say, Chairperson, it will be proper that maybe the next stage we hear the law societies, the legal profession bodies, or BLA, UNADEL, just to hear the understanding of our practicing lawyers of this concept, as well as the judges. Maybe the judicial administration and the Office of the Chief Justice, just to hear, because if the NPA is so ready, it means within the legal profession, everyone must be ready then, once these things come into operation. Maybe I'll end it there, Chair, for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Ngwabe. Honorable Pumulwana.
I suppose you should have called me before Ndade Mwa, because he looked at my notes and repeated what I was saying. Exactly, particularly the last one. I didn't talk about lawyers, but I talked about judges and magistrates. The NPA, I just wanted to find out, would you be kind enough to suggest a clause, perhaps, to in the bill, if you want it to be there, that covers the question of the challenges. What would you suggest in the question in terms of international instruments cooperation that can assist you? Question of foreign jurisdiction, which I think you are relating to. Would you perhaps suggest something that can, I mean, I would like to find out how can we assist you in that direction. Defense, I have, I don't understand whether you guys are part of the core I thought that the whole thing rests with the state security. If I understand you correctly, what you're saying that you are the guys who are given by the Constitution only power to defend any type of defense. And I thought there is also, I think state security also do have the power to defend. Not sure whether when you guys have not, when you people have not perhaps met and discussed this matter. And if possible, do you want us to have some additions to the Constitution, perhaps that... that will make it easier for you. What do you want us to do? Because there must be coordination somewhere. Are you going to coordinate this matter? Do you think that you can't give it only to the state security to coordinate? When you say hashtag bring back the Section 55. I'm not sure. I just wanted to understand. Maybe I didn't understand it well. I want to emphasize what I said in the demo. I actually saw my notes with regard to private security matters. Not only are these private security firms are owned by foreigners. Actually, people who are working there are foreigners. I know that there is a group of people from DRC, of people who belong to the old regime of Mobutu, who have got security firms in South Africa and highly trained. they are security, they are foreign people that are handling sophisticated weapons, as you correctly put it. And foreigners are actually employed. And to me, that's a very serious security risk to the country. Not only on related to cyber crime, but in various things. I think we have got an army within the country that may be more sophisticated than our defense force. So one day we find a coup. I'm not sure, but I'm saying that we need to look into that and actually check those people, their credentials, and find out and do something about it. We need to, they come here as refugees and they become bosses. Thank you very much. I forgot the other one that I wanted to raise earlier. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Pomblana. Honorable Maila.
Thanks very much, Chair. And maybe let me thank all presenters for their presentations. Across all presentations, there is emphasis on skills development. Now, linked to that, there is the issue of hacking. And as I was listening to state security, I thought I was listening to a hacker. Now, I want to understand, if we develop skills, are we creating more hackers? Because it seems like this is a case of setting a thief to catch a thief. Oh? So I want to understand this thing of hacking. So there's legal hacking, and maybe there's also hacking which is not allowed. You'll just take me through on those things. Now, the other issue which was raised by state security is the issue of developing digital IDs. Now, I want to understand, does Home Affairs have any role to play in that line? I think, Chair, those were two questions that I have. Thank you.
Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question relates to also, I think, a statement made by the Honourable Mbulwana, and my understanding that ultimately the implementation and the governance of this bill, once it becomes an act, will rest with the State Security Agency and or its minister. And I want to have answers possibly from all departments as to what their views are, given the fact that by its very nature the State Security Agency operates in secret, and that in terms of our current dispensation, the State Security Agency is not publicly accountable to the people of the country and or this parliament. So briefings the select committee receives is done in a completely confidential and secret manner. They're not able to disclose the briefings they receive. So in that lies a big problem in terms of oversight. And as the bill now stands, I want to venture the opinion or statement that we can create a situation where the State Security Agency, through the huge powers it receives in terms of this bill, can abuse that power to the detriment of the country rather than securing our constitutional integrity, our borders, the security of our people. I'm not saying that will necessarily happen, but I'm making the statement that as the bill now stands, there's no safeguards to either find out whether there's power abuse or actions in terms of this act, which is not lawful in itself. So if, for example, you look at chapter 11 of this bill, it's quite clear that the Minister of State Security must consult with various cabinet colleagues, but he does not need their consensus to make declarations of critical information infrastructure. And then if you look at the Section 57 definitions of when and how these declarations can be made, I want to say that the vagueness of these definitions in itself must raise alarm bells also in terms of oversight. There's talk of any interference, loss, damage, disruption, talk of major interference of disruptions of services, without that being defined and without any checks and balances built in terms of oversight to see how this will be implemented. So in essence, and I think the only ones who touched on this to an extent is the Defence Force, I would like to know from all other departments how they see this playing out and how they could advise us how this can be strengthened in terms of oversight. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Horn. Yeah, definitely the whole issue of the definition of cybercrime, I think, to the Department of Justice and the drafters is something that really needs to be looked at in the context of the outcome of the discussions today. And indeed, I think the issue of private security has been clearly expressed. Indeed, it needs to be looked into closer so that we can actually look as to what role the private security companies are playing and whether there's anything that we need to be concerned about in terms of security of the country. When it comes to the presentation of the SAPS, there's a number of clauses to the Department of Justice that they are concerned about that you need to go look at, maybe in consultation with CRC, so that you then come to the conclusion as to how they actually need to be dealt with. The one thing that I'm actually quite concerned about is when you, as SAPS, indicated that there's digital investigation services except for the three provinces, and Gauteng is one of them, when there is so much of crime that is happening in Gauteng. I think it's something that needs to be looked into, but I would like to have a comment as to why Gauteng is not part of this, because that's the almost like the hub of crime in South Africa, because it's an economic hub. Everybody actually floods the province, and this is why the high levels of crime in that province. To telecommunications, you indicated that you have a monitoring role. State security has got monitoring role. I don't know whether you've actually looked at the way of actually coordinating your services. Because you know, if we're not careful, there's going to be so much of duplication in terms of monitoring, which will be exercises that wouldn't be cost effective for the country. Where it's possible to coordinate, I think we need to do so, so that we don't actually duplicate whatever services we're going to be providing for the general public. For DERCO, you've indicated that the AU protocol has not been ratified. And I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, you know, ourselves as a country, we have ratified so many instruments at international level, and now we're talking about the region. But at the same time, the concern is the cost effectiveness of all this that we have rectified, because it's something, an exercise that we need to actually at some stage look at as to how much it costs the country for ratification. But at the same time, the feeling is that maybe if you don't ratify, it's going to delay the process. because there's no international relation component of this that we are doing, which can actually set us at the back footing. But at the same time, like we've expressed before as this committee, to say that we have ratified so much. We've been over enthusiastic about ratifying various international, regional, and regional treaties and protocols. But look at it in this context. But at the same time, work needs to be done. And if this is going to be delaying us, what we will actually say, the message that comes from this committee is that maybe you need to ratify, beginning with the region. And internationally, it's like there's no protocol yet that has been developed. We are ahead of the world in South Africa, as usual. We will be more advanced, but at the same time, we need to always bear in mind the cost-effectiveness of the exercises that we actually initiate. I think Honorable Breitenbach has actually requested some kinds of information as to how much this is going to cost the country and not actually also support that. I think that's it. I'm not sure if see what I wanted to ask you, defense, but it was in relation to clause number 54.3 to be amended on the definition of the mandate. I think it was when we were talking about cyber war and classification as to what that means. I think you need to actually guide the process yourself. Thank you. It's already lunch, and I'm thinking that maybe we need to break for lunch and then come back for the responses from the departments. Is that okay? Just a minute, let me find out how many minutes. About 30 minutes. Sorry. So we will come back at 2 o'clock. Thank you. Honorable.